You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West of the Brookings Institution. I'd like to welcome you to our fourth annual A. Alfred Taubman Forum. This is a series that was established through the generosity of A. Alfred Taubman, and his wife Judy is here with us in the front row. So we appreciate their generosity in helping us establish this discussion series. Our goal in this forum is to bring together leading experts to discuss public policy issues. And since the onset of the Great Recession, public discussion has focused on the best path to economic recovery. But as evidenced by our recurring legislative battles, there are different answers that have been put forward on that question. But lost in the public discussion surrounding government budgets has been consideration of austerity's implications for national politics. How has austerity shaped our political conversations? What has been the impact of that narrative on American politics, education, and healthcare? So this morning, we have three panels of experts who are here to help us discuss those questions. Our opening panel is going to focus on American politics in the age of austerity, and it features three individuals with great expertise on the topic. The panel will be moderated by Tom Edsel, who's the Joseph Pulitzer II and Edith Pulitzer Moore Professor of Journalism at Columbia University. Many of you know him as a leading expert on American politics. He is the author of five books, including his 2012 book, The Age of Austerity. Before Columbia, he served for 25 years as a reporter at the Washington Post, where he covered presidential elections, Congress, and a variety of public policy issues. So I will turn the panel over to Tom. Thank you very much.
We couldn't do that. But we do have two very interesting panelists to discuss this. Mimi Abramovitz, she is the Bertha Capon Reynolds Professor of Social Policy at Hunter College School of Social Work. She's also in the faculty of the PhD program in Social Welfare at the Graduate Center, CUNY, and a member of the consortial faculty, whatever that is, at the Murphy Center for Worker Education and Labor Studies. She, I think, will be representing a very different point of view from our other panelist, Tyler Cowen, who many of you know as the author of The Great Stagnation and a contributor to my fine paper nowadays, The New York Times. He is the Holbert L. Harris Professor of Economics at George Mason University and Director of the Mercatus Center, and he is involved in a very interesting project of teaching economics online. I don't know if you have opening statements you want to do, or our focus is on the politics of austerity, not the necessarily whether the economics are right or wrong, but what are the driving politics? And I'm hoping you could explore to some extent what drives the austerity movement from a political point of view. Let me give it to Mimi first.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to take a slightly different angle on this. I argue that one way to examine the politics of austerity is to look at it through a gender lens. That's the work that I have done, because women are largely invisible in the politics of austerity, the discussions and the outcomes. So I'll start with saying that in the 2012 presidential campaign, women's issues became a hot political issue. But many of us felt that until that time, questions of concern to women had basically fallen off the political agenda. And it's problematic because given the politics of austerity, in the broader sense of the word, women's traditional sources of support, which include marriage, the markets, and the state, have become increasingly less reliable. And when it comes to the public sector, women face what I call triple jeopardy because they are service users, workers, and union members. But they're never invited to the table to discuss what is going on. So I want to say a little bit about this, and then I hope we'll talk more about the politics, how this affects politics as we go on. So first, I mentioned three things, marriage, the markets, and the state. So many women choose not to marry. We know that today. But society still tells us, the norms are that women are supposed to rely on a male breadwinner for support. However, this institution has become less reliable. One, let's look at fewer people are marrying. There's less marriage. Marriage rates have declined. People are marrying in their late 20s instead of their early 20s. The second reason is that male breadwinners are a less reliable source of support through no fault of their own. Now, from 1945 to 1970, the economy expanded, and male workers did okay, especially if they were white. Not today. Many fewer men have jobs, and as tax and spending cuts slow economic growth, as I said, fewer men have jobs, and they earn about the same as they did in 1964. Their real earnings fell by about 19% for prime-age workers. And just read in the paper this morning that yesterday there was a big demonstration here by workers who are the federal government contracted workers, low-wage workers, and apparently they had a big demonstration here yesterday, which I didn't see, but this may be part of the problem. All this privatization of government work is they work at minimum wage or sometimes less. So they were a little upset. So it's just an example of that falling capacity to earn a full living and be a successful breadwinner. So the labor market has never been a friendly place for women, as we know, but it's also became less reliable as a source of support. Now, we did make a lot of progress, and the wage gap narrowed during the post-war years, but in this period of sluggish economy, it has slowed. Women's labor market progress has slowed. The labor force participation rate of women aged 25 to 54 has fallen to 74% in 2013. This is the lowest rate since 1991. The problem is that these job losses push women into part-time and contingent jobs that pay less. And since 2000, if I have this right, women's median earnings fell by 6%. So we have two institutions that aren't working so well. In the past, when marriage and the market failed women, they could turn to the welfare state for help. That's the area where most of my work takes place. These programs and this institution had expanded from 1935 to 1970, this post-war period known as a period of peace, prosperity, and political liberalism. Benefits and services were meager, but they were there for women who today account for 50% of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid beneficiaries, and more than two-thirds of all the means-tested income support programs. So women are the majority of service users. Those who would starve the beast would change all that. Tax cuts, retrenchment, and privatization have made the entitlements, the big ones, less accessible, and many benefits have lost their value. At the same time, there's this non-defense discretionary spending, which I'm sure people here in the room know what that means, but I often have to explain it to my students. And so these programs pay for gender-specific programs like child care and Head Start, which are linked to women and children, but also non-gender-specific programs like Pell Grants and job training. This area of spending, which is the easiest target when Congress wants to cut, is expected to drop to 2.8% of the GDP in 2022. That's the 10-year projection, 14% below its lowest point in the past 50 years, and more than 20% below the 50-year average of 3.9%. So that's a big, big problem for women. Taken together, these cuts deprive women of the economic backup, which they turn to in hard times, and it also transfers the cost of and responsibility for care work, which these programs absorbed or supported, from the state, that's the government, back to women in the home. The result of this is less consumer demand, which hurts the economy, reduced time for paid work for women, because they have to pick up the slack, and pressing women back into traditional gender roles, which women had fought to modify. So now the next thing I want to add is that the downsizing of the government places women in triple jeopardy, as I mentioned before, because they are also public sector employees and they're also public sector union members, and they are the majority in those categories as well as in service users. Most people focus on one group or the other, but not all three, and I've been looking at all three because they overlap and they also are all affected. That's why I say triple jeopardy. No matter where women are, they're being affected by austerity. Now, for years, and this is a problem because for years, these public sector jobs were the main route of upward mobility for white women and men and women of color when the private sector didn't care to hire us. These government jobs are often better paying and more secure than private sector work. Now, program cuts that hurt the users translate into job cuts for the people who work in the programs. And since 2009, when the recovery began, the loss of public sector jobs has wiped out 21% of the private sector gains that women had been making. By the way, the states that went red in 2010 election were responsible for 40% of the public sector job losses in 2011, 70% if you count Texas. Women also predominated among public sector union members, losing hard-won union protections. You all know that fewer than 7% of private sector workers now belong to a union. It's less than before the New Deal. I think it's 6.6%. I said less than 7. So now the foes of unions have turned their sights onto the public sector unions, which at 35% have held their own till now and continue to fight for job security, income security, and a narrow gender gap for their members, which affects all workers in the end. So seeking to convince the public that collective bargaining rights rather than tax cuts are the enemy of the balanced budget, governors demonize public employees, which I'm sure you've heard since Wisconsin a couple years ago, and fuel fears of the deficit that their own tax policies help to create. This speaks to Naomi Klein's notion of the shock doctrine of creating a crisis, manipulating it, and then using it to justify policies that people might not otherwise stand for. So in closing, the effort to balance the budget on the backs of women reduces their economic independence, turns the economic crisis into a care crisis, and interrupts the progress towards gender and racial equality. Now, groups such as United Against the War on Women, which I think is recently formed, are organizing a grassroots around the country to let people know and the politicians know that they are not taking this pain and the punishment that comes with austerity lying down. Thank you.
Tyler?
Whenever I hear the word austerity, I get a little uncomfortable because austerity is defined relative to a baseline. So in Washington, you'll find people who insist Obama has brought in over $1 trillion of spending cuts and people who insist that's not true. And they're either both right or they're both wrong, depending on the baseline you choose. So I prefer to think of this all as a sectoral shift in what we're spending our money on. So we're spending less on discretionary items in the federal budget, and especially over time, we'll be spending more on entitlements, most of all Medicare. This strikes me as exactly the wrong way to go, but when you view it as a sectoral shift, it's a somewhat different framing than to think of it in terms of austerity. It's highly likely that government spending in this country will grow over time, especially 10 years out and beyond. So that's not exactly austerity in the way that it's sometimes discussed. I would stress the major changes are yet to come, but we've already seen some changes. One thing I've changed my mind on a lot in the last year is I think we have much less gridlock than I used to think or that we used to see. There's a lot of key policy areas where when you look past the noise, I think we've made big decisions. So Medicare, we're going to expand. I know all about the Ryan plan and what people say, but we're going to expand Medicare. Republicans have too many elderly white voters. The Payments Advisory Board has more or less faded away. That's been decided. the Social Security deal. It hasn't been made yet. We'll make it at the last minute in the worst possible way. It'll be stupid. People will say stupid things. But it seems like we're going to make one. Medicaid is being diminished. I think that's also pretty clear. It's not that I think all those states will stay out of the extension. It wouldn't shock me if all or most of them ended up signing on. I just think the fact that it's even gotten this far shows the underlying constituencies for Medicaid, politically speaking, just aren't that powerful. What we're going to do with defense spending, I think, now is more or less clear. So, again, there's a lot of cycling, a lot of noise, a lot of lies, most of all here in Washington. But I think it's shaping up what decisions we'll be making. A lot of them are bad ones, but there you go. So I believe in gridlock as a positive reality less than I used to. I would stress any time a Republican says something, probably on these issues you need to take it with a grain of salt. So I come from academia. Most academics are Democrats. It's very common for people to say the Republicans are a mix of stupid and or outrageous. I would just stress a lot of what they say on these issues, it's for their base or for donors or for other reasons. What the Republican Party really is about, like any other political party, is ruling and extending its power. And the last time Republicans ran our government, they extended spending, entitlement spending, really quite a bit. And that's what they're going to do next time around, insofar as they can, insofar as budget constraints allow. So just don't be distracted by the noise. When it comes to a lot of the key issues, not Medicaid, but a lot of the key issues, the differences between the two parties are much less than one might think. The Republicans are much less ideological than it sounds. They really are about ruling, and when push comes to shove, they're willing to throw over a lot of what they say, dump it into the ocean, and go about and rule. That should be no surprise. So what do I predict as the adjustments? Again, I've changed my mind on this a fair amount. I think 5 years ago I thought, well, there'll just be a big tax increase sometime in the future. There'll be some tax increases, but that's looking less likely. Voters just seem to love cash more than a lot of us had thought. And it may not even be like permanent lifetime income cash, just like cash now, don't take it from me, it's mine, don't raise my taxes. Way stronger than I had expected. I think Medicaid will take a big whacking. And again, I think all those states, maybe minus Texas, will sign on at some point. But that's not the point. There'll be a lot more rationing in Medicaid. It's just not that popular. 10 to 15 years out, something has to give. That's by far the most likely candidate. Medicare will remain strong forever. It will drag our economy down. We'll spend too much there. It's exactly where we should spend less and spend more in federal discretionary areas. We're not going to do that. It's a big mistake. But I think it's pretty clear what will happen. We'll just do more and more, fund things more and more in inefficient ways through regulations, through mandates, through disguised taxes. I think we'll freeze a lot of benefits. People will adjust by moving to cheaper areas. We'd be better off just to make a lot of explicit upfront decisions like, we're going to give cash to these people to solve this problem, but we have to pretend we're doing things in a certain way to get past what would otherwise be our gridlock, and we'll just see a lot of inefficient responses to our fiscal constraints. And that's what I think our future looks like, pretty ill-considered, not nearly enough emphasis on cash transfer, too little federal discretionary spending, too much Medicare, you know, a big mess. I actually think we'll get through it. Just a second, one point Mimi made. When I think, like, in the future, 20 years from now, who are the biggest losers? I think it's quite possibly the class of women who would like to have more than one child, say women who want three kids or maybe even five kids. On average, that class in proportional terms will maybe suffer the biggest losses. There are more old people all the time. So what you would call old white people will be taken pretty good care of. America will continue. It's not what I want to see, but there you go.
Mimi, let me ask you, you talk about these cuts in austerity, particularly affecting women. Do you think this is the motive of the people who are making the cuts, that there is an agenda behind this, that it is a political calculation?
I would say yes and no, mostly no. Mostly I don't think it's an agenda. It's a consequence of other agendas that no one is paying attention to. When you have them, you know, anything that hits the public sector now, since women are predominate everywhere in jobs, service users, and union members, is going to affect women. And many of these women are women of color, so it's a race and gender whammy that's occurring. I don't think it's deliberate, but the people who work in Washington and Congress and all the staffers are much smarter than me, and they predict consequences. So they know who is going to be affected. So it's not deliberate, but maybe it's a little bit negligent. But I would also say that the other side of the story is that, you know, during the period when women made a lot of gains along with the civil rights movement and all and the labor movement, these gains helped expand the welfare state. They helped expand the role of the government. So there has been, I think, a deliberate effort to reverse those gains and in all three of those areas, and looking just at the area of women's rights, to the extent that that has been part of the agenda for the past 30 years, then there's a deliberateness. You can just, if you want to use the abortion, the right to abortion as an example, it's been a very deliberate attempt to take back that right, very deliberate attempt to take back other kinds of rights that women fought very hard for and won. So some programs, yes, some programs, no. But if you're going to cut entitlements, if you're going to cut discretionary, non-defense discretionary, which is a chunk of the discretionary, you are going to be affecting lots of women. And if I can figure it out, I'm not an economist, I teach social workers, if I can figure that out, so it's not simply benign or accidental, or just simply mean-spirited, which I think it is mean-spirited.
I would disaggregate that category, women, just a bit. I have a simple five-word theory
of American politics. Old people do not lose. I think it's a pretty good predictive theory. A lot of old people are women, in fact. Now, if you're 78 years old, a lot of discretionary spending just really doesn't benefit you at all, even if you're 62 years old. On net, I'd say a lot of discretionary spending benefits the young. Medicare benefits the elderly. It also may benefit their children who otherwise would have to take care of them. But still, relatively well-off elderly women, especially white women, will be treated relatively well by our politics. The fundamental principle here is old people do not lose, my five-word theory of American politics.
If I could just say in response that many women who are over 65 live in poverty. So not all old people win. Some win more than others. It depends on who you are. So, and especially women of color, as always, are worse off than white women. But there are many old white women who are hobbling around New York streets with no money. Okay, so that's a problem. And second, I'd just like to address a point that was made earlier about the only ones who want something better are women who want two or three kids. Well, that's a very few number of women. The average family size is about 2.3 or something nationwide, and also for all women, and also for women on welfare, which that is kind of a sidelong reference to. So I don't think that it's a matter of women wanting kids who are the ones who are going to benefit from a certain kind of program. Women take care of the nation's kids. They are 67% of the informal caregivers, whether they work or not. Either they do it on their own or they get some support. And I try to give you three sources of support that are much less available. So when we cut programs, especially the means-tested programs like Medicaid, food stamps, TANF, and so on, we are hitting the same women who are getting hit by the non-defense discretionary cuts. So they are getting hit right and left by the loss of a standard of living that was never very good before. And so my question is, why? What's the point of all this, especially since we're learning now that the deficit is somewhat of a choice, the so-called deficit. It's the Congressional Budget Office just reported that it's smaller now than it's been for a while. Medicare costs, the main driver of the deficit, is starting to shrink. Then we know about the flawed research that drove this austerity politics in the United States and Europe over the past 30 years. Look at Europe. I mean, we know that we have not had the growth that these austerity politics are supposed to produce. So why? I mean, if this is all a bit of a manufactured crisis, it's hurting people, but not the people who perhaps produce the crisis or who are benefiting from it.
Please get ready to ask questions from the audience. Let me just ask one more here for Tyler. Your remarks seem to downplay any concern or a serious concern over the total debt reaching tipping point or dangerous levels. Am I misinterpreting what you were saying?
Well, for the next 10 years, fiscally, we're absolutely fine. And even after that, the problems kick in somewhat slowly. The difficulty is we adjust to fiscal problems only slowly, especially as fiscal problems become based more and more in Medicare and Social Security. There's a sense that people have, entirely justified in my view, well, I paid into these programs, I expect a certain amount back. So there's some kinds of spending you can cut on a dime, but the kinds of spending we're growing to specialize in are very hard to you know, turn on a dime and just cut. So it's completely correct to say that right now there absolutely is no fiscal problem. It's also correct to say right now there is a huge fiscal problem because the ways in which we're spending, we don't know how to cut quickly when the time comes that we'll need to make an adjustment. I would just also push back once again on the word austerity. Look at the sequester, which we've actually done. In nominal terms, even the sequester is not cutting defense spending, although that's half of it. And in real terms, defense spending is roughly constant over the next 10 years. And that's what we're calling austerity. Yes, it is austerity relative to a baseline that it would have gone up a whole lot more. But let's just keep this reality fundamentally in mind. In this country, government spending very, very likely is going up over time, especially 10 years and out. It's not really austerity. It's that we're spending more on old people and less on young people. This gets back to the point about women. Women are more likely to be caregivers. If you spend less on young people, this, on average, will hurt women more than it will hurt men.
Down here.
Thank you for this panel. I have two questions. If you're going to look at austerity as if it's a policy that we are or are not embracing, and we've sort of imported it from Europe, why don't people understand what's really happening in Europe? And that is that Germany's the dominant country. It's set up the EU to suit its own self-interests. It's people are fully employed. The free trade zone works to advantage the German national champions, which then can export on the same currency. And so now what you're seeing is that the German people really don't want to pay anymore for the peripheral countries, which are low-rate wage countries, to come in. And so you have a contraction over there, in part because it's a dysfunctional setup anyway to have helped the reunification of Germany. But so we did free trade in not doing a direct transfer payment to help Germany. My question is that when we violate our Constitution, which calls for us to use tariffs, and all of a sudden our policies then, which we've used to suit the Europeans, we've stopped using our tariffs. We've stopped using our indirect taxation, our revenue mechanism for our government. So all the budget cutting that you're talking about is happening in part because we're accommodating the Germans and the Europeans. So why are we importing the flawed policies that are happening in Europe and dysfunctionalizing our own economy? That's question number one. And then number two is...
Let's do that one first.
Well, a lot of the defense spending does contracting with non-defense companies. And so you're going to look at a huge contraction if you're going to cut the defense budget. And that's a lot of private sector, you know, employment. So if you could speak to those two points.
It's really a lot of... There are many different issues in your question. First, Eurozone was a huge mistake. It's not working. I wouldn't blame Germany per se. They hoped it would work more than anyone else, and partly they had their arm twisted to do the whole thing in the first place by the French. But the problems in Europe, real as they may be for Europe, it only has a small impact on the United States, some fraction of a percentage point of GDP growth. It's bad for us, but it's just far from our major problem. I would also say people use the word austerity applied to the Eurozone, but it's highly misleading. Greece has cut government spending a lot. In most of the other countries, you see a shift in government spending, but aggregate government spending has gone up. The French have not really pared back their public sector. They're now having huge problems. So just to say there's this thing, Europe, it's done austerity, and thus it's fallen apart, I know that's not exactly what you said, but I don't think that's really an accurate picture. So Europe needs to figure out some way of undoing the Eurozone and or making it work. That's going to, it's like a 10-year project. It will be very ugly.
I guess I would just say that underlying a lot of these discussions, our discussions and the questions now and probably to come, is that there's a problem with government spending, aside from the deficit. But one of the reasons that the spending on entitlements, for example, especially for senior citizens, go up is because the population is of that population is increasing, and it's going to increase a lot more. So are we supposed to abandon the needs of the people who are reaching senior citizenship because of our economic problems, which could be solved possibly in other ways? So the other reason that government expenditures grow, one is the increase in population, one is the inflation, the cost of everything goes up, and another is that new needs emerge. Like, remember when HIV/AIDS emerged, you know, when all these disasters like Oklahoma, that costs the government a lot of money. So the reasons that this government spending goes up are things that I think we all want the government to pay for. But the argumentation is so hostile to government spending, it's focused on the low-income people, the low-income people that social workers see. So that makes it easier for people to say, okay, let's cut. But many times they're cutting, the nose to cut off, what is it, they're hurting themselves, thank you, cutting their nose to spite their face. So I think that's another issue to sort of factor into this. The government spending, there should be amount of government spending, and our refusal to raise taxes really is a choice. We could have done a bigger stimulus. Now, these are all political, ideological decisions. I understand that. But decisions are a choice. So we could decide to make sure that people in need were taken care of a little better. No one's saying luxury, but taken care of so they're not homeless. And the rest of us could pay a little more in taxes. And, you know, I remember when Clinton was president, and he said, okay, let's focus taxes on just one thing. And most of the people said, okay, I'll pay for that. But we don't do that anymore. Tax reduction is the political issue, and it's used to create a deficit that then leads to those who are really hostile to big government or government at all to convince us. How do people get convinced to cut off their nose to spite their face? What convinces the average person? So that's my question. So I'd like to factor that into our discussion about austerity as somewhat of a manufactured crisis.
Go ahead.
Professor Cowan gave sort of a kind of a classic a public choice linking of politicians' response to voter needs or voter desires, I should say, and I thought you showed a refreshing cynicism about Republican rhetoric, and I would show the same about Democratic rhetoric as an academic liberal. But I think one thing that's missing out of the equation is the role of the providers in Medicare. You sort of showed a model of politicians responding to what the beneficiaries want, but in Medicare, I think you got a lot of political action, which was actually driven by providers. I mean, you mentioned the fading away of the payment advisory board, and I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, the whole death panel thing. But to a large extent, I guess the classic question is, you know, do you agree? I think a large part of that was that people like Sarah Palin, who kind of stirred up this hysteria, were just useful idiots for those parts of the provider community that actually make extraordinarily good livings off of Medicare. I'm just interested in your reaction.
I agree completely with that, and I would say the politics are overdetermined. So old people, on average, support Medicare, and of course providers do as well, and that makes it all the harder to overturn that lock on our government's finances. And I understand Mimi's point about tax increases, and there's a number of ways in the past I've called for those myself. But I think the problem is this. People look at government, and they see something which is controlled, what they view is not by them. Even if you believe in a median voter theorem, most people aren't the median voter. They view it as controlled not by them. And you're telling them you're going to take cash away from them, and basically someone else spends it on something else. And it's just not very popular. And even if it's Benthamite utilitarian welfare improving, I think at some level we need to come to terms with the fact that people really have not been sold on higher taxes as a way of making them better off. And it's not ideology. It's not some kind of strange, you know, the Republicans have taken over the country. The average person likes cash in his or her pocket. And if you, you know, told someone, well, we're going to borrow money for you at 0% real rate, but someone else gets to spend it on your behalf and you have to pay it back, how do you feel about that? Like, say it was even my best friend or one of my colleagues at George Mason, I'd get pretty nervous. And somehow the talk about raising taxes, that needs to be more central, like understanding why a lot of average Americans who are not ideologues are not really sold on the case for raising taxes other than on very wealthy people.
I think one of the reasons why people are not sold on raising taxes is that for the past 30 years, the idea that government can do any good has been attacked, the government has been demonized. Big government is bad, but government. Clinton said the era of big government is over. Since Reagan, and actually before that, the idea that Washington's a bureaucratic mess and all this. So why should people want to raise, pay taxes for this? But if we had a socially responsible leadership, they might talk about how government takes care of your needs. I wrote a paper once called Everyone's on Welfare. If you count Medicaid, Medicare, and various other programs, and other books have come out with that since then, the shadow welfare state, the submerged state, everybody benefits from government spending. Why don't we promote that idea, and then people might be willing to be taxed to pay for the basic services they need. It's an old argument, but I think I understand why people don't want to pay taxes now, but they've been convinced that paying taxes is not in their interest. But we could convince them otherwise if we so choose.
Do either of you think that the notion of that people have a notion of the undeserving poor and that this notion may have been intensified by the racial makeup of those who are poor, the racial and ethnic makeup, that has had what has motivated a considerable part of this anti-tax drive?
No doubt about it. I have no doubt about it. And I would add that some of the gridlock has to do with the fact we have a black president and the open statements that they don't want him to be successful and didn't want him to have a second term. So you have to factor race into almost everything in terms of public policy these days. Now, there's a considerable literature on the racialization of poverty that started, as the civil rights movement began to, the gains started to be institutionalized, we started to have the backlash. The Nixon Southern Strategy, the Reagan Democrats, they used race cards to woo people away from public spending, away from the idea that government was helpful to everybody. So I think we can't escape it, and I appreciate you asking the question, because the so-called undeserving poor, people of color are overrepresented among the people who use Medicaid, food stamps, and they're often women of color as well. So it's very easy to talk about the urban poor, to talk about the welfare mother without mentioning the word race, but everybody understands that race is the issue here and that, it needs to be discussed. So I'm glad you raised the question.
Just on that, I would reframe the phrase undeserving poor, and race and ethnicity here, they're two very different things. So sometimes Latinos is called a race issue, and I don't want to get into that. But here's what I think is a common attitude among ordinary Americans. A lot of immigrants have come to this country. A lot of them are Latinos. This is fine, but people are reluctant to see their taxes go up to pay for that. It's not just in the United States. You see it in the United Kingdom. You see it in a lot of parts of Europe. Where you don't see it, there tends to be some kind of resource boom. To say people feel this is the undeserving poor is to make them sound more mean and more spiteful than maybe they are. From my point of view, this is an entirely reasonable attitude to say to the world, we will gladly take in more immigrants, but if you come here at the beginning, you are not receiving the same benefits as American citizens. You don't have to think the people are undeserving or somehow worse. We are, in fact, probably in the process of expanding immigration, and there may be some kind of amnesty. This is great. I would do a lot more. But I also think the global movement to say we'll take in people but they don't get the same benefits is an entirely reasonable point of view from a moral perspective.
From Reagan to Romney, they've identified the people who use public benefits as the undeserving poor. So the language, not accurate, and I don't agree with it, is how the American public has been taught to think about low-income public sector people, now workers as well as service users. Also, I would say that I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me that our immigration policy has got increasingly punitive as the immigrants were more increasingly of color. And that started in the mid-60s with the change in the immigration policy, as I understand it. So there's been a racialization of that, too, and I think that feeds, in addition to some of the things that you said, I think that makes it easier for people to be hostile to immigrants when, in fact, many employers would prefer to have this labor force available to them.
Go ahead. You.
Hi there, Elaine K. Mark from Brookings. I have a question for Mimi and a question for Tyler, if I could.
Sure.
Mimi, I think you're absolutely right pointing out that the decrease in labor union membership is part of what's happened to particularly working poor men and women. But it preceded substantially this recession. Now, and it also hasn't happened as much in Western European countries. So I'm wondering what happened, there's been some books written about this, and I'm very curious. I've never heard a good explanation for what happened to the labor movement in America. Why, you know, is there some fault on the part of the labor union leadership as well as in these macro trends? And then for Tyler, I just want you to clarify Medicaid, okay? You said that it will decrease in importance and support, and yet Medicaid is not actually, it's billed as a poor people's entitlement. It's not. It pays for most of the long-term care in the country. And so, in fact, it's just a hidden long-term care insurance, and therefore it seems to me Medicaid also falls under your very clever description that old people always win, because I can't imagine anybody doing anything substantially different with Medicaid, given the number of elderly people who, and therefore families, who rely on that for nursing home care, since we don't have a formal long-term care program in the country. So one
Maybe
for each.
First.
Okay, so labor unions. So two things. There are two figures to keep in mind. One is that the private sector unionization is down to 6.6%. Public sector unionization is still 35%. That is the same number as when the AFL-CIO had the most members in about 1954 and 1955, right? So the private sector down, public sector held its own. So what happened to the private sector? Well, first of all, there were economic trends. There's globalization, deindustrialization, all of that. But there was also, starting with Reagan, when he fired the PATCO workers, the air traffic controllers, and it was all over the papers that this was permission for employers to go after labor unions. And union membership has been declining, a combination of both economic forces and those who would thought labor unions were eating too much into corporate profits, so they wanted lower wages. One way to lower wages is to make sure that there's no one negotiating for higher wages. So I think that's pretty widely accepted. And so with my eye on the public sector then, so we basically have 93% of the workforce non-unionized. The private sector unionization is gone. So now there's another sector. So starting with the Scott Walker in Wisconsin and maybe before, there's been an attempt to take away collective bargaining rights. And so that's starting to take hold. But what's interesting, that as I start to watch a new trend, seems to be that workers who are not traditional employees, traditional workers, that is those who don't have a single employer, domestic workers, low-wage restaurant workers, now these privatized government workers, some of them have single employers where you typically unions form, but you have domestic workers who are employed everywhere, and they're starting to try to organize themselves into some kind of force that can protect their situation. And this is, you can't open the paper one day after another or watch a TV newscast to see some discussion of this. So it's like out of the ashes of the old, if you will, there's a new force. The rise of low-wage workers in the low-paid service sector, they are starting to try to figure out what to do about their circumstances. So I don't know if that answers your question, but and I would just say that women, again, bring the gender issue back. Women are either overrepresented or largely present in all those places.
Tyler?
I think your question about long-term care is exactly right. That's the part of Medicaid which will be treated well. In a 10 to 20-year time horizon, you can even imagine it being federalized or upgraded or rolled into Medicare, or being the splendid Americans that we are, we might just create a parallel program within Medicare, which would be insane, but it's easy enough to imagine. And that's the part of Medicaid which will do well, and the other parts will do less well. And it's what? Long-term care is a third of Medicaid, I think? It's big, but there's plenty that will be cut. Plenty left.
You've been waiting. Go ahead.
I'm just curious about the rationale for the Republican Party in opposing public investment. It would seem to be that this might be helpful to Obama. It would stimulate the economy, create jobs, and just to sabotage that, they oppose it. But it's also probable that neither party, from your analysis, neither Republicans nor Democrats are willing to cut entitlement spending to have money left over for public investment or education. So could you address the issue of public investment and the opposition to it?
Yeah, Jeff Sachs has written a lot on this lately, and he's not exactly a spokesman for the Heritage Foundation. And Sachs points out that in Obama's own budgets, discretionary spending is slated to fall significantly. Here's a way to think about it. The one thing I think our government should do much, much more of, not just double, not triple, a lot more of, is research and development support at a basic level in a lot of areas, healthcare, energy, many areas. And that seems to be the one area that has the least support from voters, Republicans, Democrats. It's just those benefits are not easily organized. They're actually long-term. They wouldn't help Obama now. And they fall by the wayside. So I think it's a quite general phenomenon. I don't think it's that Republicans or Bill Clinton, you know, have been talking down government for too long. I don't think it's that voters have false consciousness. There's just a way in which it's long-term, it's abstract, it doesn't have people mobilized on its behalf, and neither party is really that keen for doing it. And I think that's the future. I think it's bad. Entitlement spending, it's pretty clear who's fighting for that.
If I could just say one word about entitlement spending and Social Security. I think everybody knows that Social Security payments do not go into the bucket that's called the Treasury. It goes into the Social Security Trust Fund. So it has little or nothing to do with the deficit. And, yes, we are now facing the prospect of a chain CPI, which will, over the long term, reduce the value of Social Security benefits. That's another thing I don't understand, that the American public doesn't seem to put two and two together, or one and one together, to see that the Social Security gets thrown into this package, including by the president, when it's not part of the problem. And then I would also argue the problem isn't a real problem in the first place. But put that aside, Social Security is being thrown in. And I think it's really, really dangerous, because once we start tampering with entitlements, you can be sure that in a while they will become means-tested. And then we will have no universal programs, and then we will really not, we'll have an irresponsible social welfare system.
Let me ask Mimi a question, or maybe both. You talk about Republicans creating the anti-public sector people, the anti-undeserving poor. How much did they create it, and how much were they capitalizing on sentiments that were already there?
Absolutely capitalizing. We have a conservative culture. I think it's a highly racialized culture. So, you know, during the post-war period and when the civil rights and all the other movements were active, either people changed their minds or they just didn't say things that they thought were no longer acceptable. So now some of these things are more acceptable. And so some politicians, not all of them, are smart enough to play the race card or the gender card or the immigrant card. I mean, there's, you know, and so the politics of hate begin to be useful politically. So obviously if it didn't work, they'd stop, because then they would just be criticized for being bigots or whatever you want to call them. But it works. It works because our culture, it's built into our culture, goes all the way back. So that's a big transformation, a big thing to change. But we're living with the product of the consequences of letting those sentiments fester below the surface, and not so below the surface anymore.
Go ahead, Todd.
I just view America as being more tolerant than that. Again, look at the actual results. Before 1965, the restrictions on most foreign migration from most countries were extreme. And that's been dropped in a way which has been earth-shattering, and I think largely a good thing. I certainly favor it. I would liberalize immigration more. And that's become a fact of life. It's not going to be overturned. We're probably doing some more immigration reform. So when you do a lot on immigration, any country that's done that, including Sweden, including Switzerland, you do get some backlash. So you can look at the backlash and talk about different intolerances. But if you focus on the net change in the numbers, what you see in the United States since 1965 is a massive shift toward letting in more people from a large number of countries. It is institutionalized. It's worked pretty well. It's what this country is, and most people accept that. And I think that's the more important truth than just to look at some of the complaints about that process.
Well, if I could just say, I agree with you and that, but the American public is a humanitarian public, but they've also been convinced to think otherwise. They've played into these other cultural trends that it's made it easy for them to accept the anti-immigration policies that are rampant in some states, that, and I don't have to spell them out here. So you have to answer, well, the policy's been liberalized. Why is there so much hostility? Yes, backlashes are normal when changes take place, but the depth of this punitive policies is rather overwhelming, breaks up families, all that. I mean, and so the two don't go together so well. Something else is going on there.
I'm afraid we're running out of time. This has been very interesting. I think we could have gone on for another 2 hours productively, maybe not to the audience, but at least I would have liked to. But anyway, thank you very much, Tyler and Mimi, and now we got to move forward to the next step. But
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was fun.
It was.
Thanks for moderating.
Sure.
We didn't actually meet. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I read your piece on the pandemics a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. I sent you a note about it. What's your name?
Gallagher.
Oh, okay.
I forgot to mention that. What? I meant to say that I
did not understand how to change you.
I wish you would, because that was one of my notes to say, and I went on so long. I absolutely, I've been very angry at them and the anti-democratic and all that.
Credible enough to get more investment.
Right.
I mean, a long time. They
right.
can say it tomorrow. Are people going to believe it? Who knows?
Right, they were, and they still are. You know, in New York, I saw them coming in.
Yeah. We're going to start our next panel.
dollars. If you give it to Congress, they spend it very badly. But that's what Congress took in line.
Okay, but is there any fundamental opposition to infrastructure?
Not in the abstract. Now, when you actually sit down, who gets to spend that much? No one likes how you're going to do it.
Right, railroads are the benefit of the needs. But you think in the Republican administration for the future, there will be infrastructure.
The best chance of getting it is to have the people able to have the size of the
I'm not saying they necessarily do it. Do you have a particular order you want to
see? I think that we'll go. If you could sit there, yes. I have a plan.
Oh, okay. Yes. Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, you came out to...
That one time I came out there. That's right. That was so fun. It was cold. Yeah, we're doing... Yeah, okay. Yes.
Should we go ahead and start?
Yeah, I think so.
Hello. Make sure this works. My name is Lee Gardner. I'm an editor. I'm the editor of the Finance and Policy section of the Chronicle of Higher Education here in Washington. And we're here to talk about the effects of budget cuts on higher education in the United States. And I'm particularly pleased to be here with the people sitting here on this panel with me because I think they're well-chosen lot to discuss this particular topic. I did not choose them, so that's not me giving myself a pat on the back. Dr. John Aubrey Douglas is a senior research fellow for public policy and higher education at the Center for Studies in Higher Education at the University of California at Berkeley. Further down the panel, Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Robb is Associate Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She's also a Senior Scholar at the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Post-Secondary Education and an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty, Center for Financial Security, La Follette School of Public Affairs, and Wisconsin Center for Educational Research. Did I miss anything? Okay. And Zakiya Smith is a strategy director at the nonprofit Lumina Foundation, focusing on student financial support in higher education. And before that, not that long ago, she was a senior policy advisor for education in President Obama's White House. So, higher education gets a lot of attention in the media, and not just in dedicated media like the Chronicle these days, but I wanted to start by laying out a little bit of the picture in case you haven't been keeping up. State appropriations for higher education have fallen over the past 6 years, sometimes drastically. Using the state of California as an example, the three tiers of the state's renowned higher education system, more than 150 campuses, were cut by about $2.7 billion between 2008 and 2012. That's about a quarter of the three systems' pre-recession budget. Colleges, both public and private, have often looked to increase tuition to offset their expenses and the loss of other support, but students and families seem to be nearing or have exceeded the limits of their ability or willingness to spend more. A very popular figure to bandy around these days is the fact that student debt overall has reached a volume of $1 trillion. Federal Pell grants for lower-income students have been shielded from the current round of sequestration cuts, and I don't know if we'll get to this in our discussion much today, but federal research spending is not, potentially imperiling not only scientific research, but the careers of the STEM specialists we hope will fuel future eras of American innovation. Which brings us why we're here today, to discuss the effects of budget austerity on higher education in the United States and what, if anything, may be done to mitigate, reverse, and deal with those effects. What have we lost and what do we stand to lose? I wanted to start by asking Dr. Douglas, California is an especially ripe example for this. One of my favorite statistics is that 1 in 9 college students, about 1 in 9 college students in the United States, attends a California state institution. I was wondering, in your work and your observation of the system, if you could talk about the effects of recent budget cuts on the state systems and on the state itself, and how you see that playing out if the current situation continues.
First, thanks to the Brookings Institute for inviting me and the Tubman family for this forum. A macro issue in the U.S. generally, but exaggerated in states like Texas and California, is population growth. And that's, in fact, when we were having the previous discussion about austerity, that has to be put into the equation. And there are disproportionate differences, you know, where Maryland is or Massachusetts in population growth versus other states like California, which is the largest state in the union, nearly twice the size of any other state. Nearly the 7th, 8th, depending on how you count it, depending on where we are in the financial problems of the world, the 9th or 10th, 8th largest economy in the world. It has also, just as an historical reference, it really is the first state to develop a coherent approach to mass higher education, and there's a direct link, I believe, with that success of that story over the years with economic development, socioeconomic mobility, these kinds of things. So this macro issue of population growth sits there, not only, you know, just maintaining services, but how you grow. So California is an interesting case example. And I could say how the state of California goes, so goes the nation in terms of educational attainment rates. That's probably a bit of an exaggeration.
People say that all the time.
But to kind of twist that slightly before I talk about really quickly the problems we're facing in a place like California, which is, a case study, a useful one, I think. Another thing I like to tell people when they're thinking about higher education in the U.S. is how state governments do and their budgets, so goes American higher education. The federal government is extremely important in the area of financial aid and obviously research funding, but really the operational structural issues, and which is actually, you know, part of our nation's history, is it's the responsibility of states to operate and develop their higher education sector. So how states go, so goes U.S. higher education and educational attainment rates. And then when you look at state governments, of course, there's a similar story of entitlements and discretionary funding. Higher education is in that little shrinking part of discretionary funding and is constantly being put lower and lower on the overall list when you're looking at this growing healthcare costs for states, pensions, problems of various types, prisons, huge. You know, we spend more money in California on prisons than we do on public higher education. And then you look at the disproportionate amount of students that are in public higher education. Generally in the U.S., it's about 70% of all the students are in higher are in public institutions. In California, it's over 80%. And this is, you'll see the difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. And I think also just to give you a sense of how important the public sector is, you know, you also have to disaggregate. You know, people always talk about the brand name institutions, the Berkeleys, the Wisconsins, whatever. But most people are in, the majority are in, just a little less than majority is in community colleges. In California, 70% of all the students are in community colleges. So, all right, so now you've got to disaggregate. And you look at costs, so you have to disaggregate, you know, what the cost it is to go to Bowdoin versus to go to a CSU Sacramento. These kinds of things are very different, and the populations are different. So the net effect, quickly, related to the financial problems that the state of California has had, which, again, I think might be more exaggerated than just about any other state, and that's a very interesting political story stretches back to Prop 13 and tax revolts, but I won't get into that. What we're seeing is really large cuts, as you were noting, to the higher education sector, 30%, 25%, depending on what base year you talk about. We're talking about billions of dollars of disinvestment from the state in a state where population continues to grow. So what are the net effects? Well, the biggest one, what I would say, is we're seeing beginning to see a breakdown in the coherency to California's mass higher ed system, which is highly differentiated. You have the University of California, and it provides doctoral degrees and access, but only services around 4 to 5% of the state's population in terms of the total higher ed sector. CSU focuses on up to the master's degree and accepts around 33% of the high school grads that come in, and it's an important component. But again, as I noted to you, community colleges are just gigantic. And what's happened in these large-scale budget cuts is they're not also planned. You don't get a warning, here's your budget, now plan the fiscal year. You're getting $100 million cuts midway through the budget year. We're beginning to see stability now, so there's some hope that we're basically what I say is treading water. We're not improving, but we don't have quite the crisis mode. But the individual institutions are taking action to try to control costs, and they're laying off faculty. They've been having forced salary cuts. Again, there's the beginning of a different picture now with some recovery in the economy. But the biggest factor that really worries me is that these institutions have said, you know, we've had a social contract to accept students. Well, we have to bend those in some way. So UC, at the edge, but it's a very important warning, has said, well, we're not going to accept around 2,500 students who normally would come into the system. Now, that's a pretty small percentage of a system with 240,000 students, and that's graduate students as well. But it's a significant break in the social contract. The biggest player is CSU, the California State University, which has said, no, we can't take 25,000 students, and that we normally would bring in, because we don't have funding, and you haven't been funding, about a third of our students, according to the formulas and agreements that were made a decade before. But those are discrete conscious decisions by the institutions as to try to control ways of controlling costs. At the community colleges, it's less coordinated, and basically we don't have the money to hire a faculty person to teach a course, and therefore the net effect was around 250,000 students that normally would be in the system have not been able to get courses and not enter. So these are really big effects. And I'm very worried. One of the things that's occurring is what I call the Brazilian effect, not to get too much into that, but it's a linking of what you see in other developing economies. We have elements of a very developed economy and a lot of elements of an underdeveloped economy. And if you look at places, whether it's Poland and Brazil, obviously I picked as an example, what happens when there's public demand for higher education continues to grow and there are goals to increase those attainment rates, those national governments that can't figure a way to deal with it basically try to look to the private for-profit sector to fill that need and create policies and structures to help with that. And that's what we're seeing right now. So you see a growth in the for-profit sector. Even there's been some changes with the Obama administration that have added some difficulties to that growth, but you still have a gigantic growth. And that's a high-cost, high-attrition system. So my feeling is, just in the short term, my concluding remark here is that I have a feeling that educational attainment rates are probably going down in California at the current educational attainment. That means getting a degree, not necessarily enrollment. A lot of people enrolling but dropping out, and that's what we have in California. So I'm very worried that this is a really large historical shift in socioeconomic mobility and educational attainment, I think, in California.
Well, and just a quick follow-up, I know that a number of people have written a bit about California. A lot of people like to bring up that not only is the higher ed system struggling, but, as you say, population's increasing. In a bad economy, people go back to school, so demand for access is increasing. And at the same time, the state's economy is going to need, hundreds of thousand more college graduates to bolster its labor market in the coming decade or so. Do I have that more or less right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, California has depends on a talented labor pool in order to boost its economy. There's an estimate, and you have to take these with a grain of salt, that we need another million college graduates just to keep up with the labor force. And if I was to
could look back at the Obama administration has put up a goal also for degree attainment rates by 2020, and it says, you know, we're all supposed to beat or meet the top European and other developed economies. We would need to create in the nation 8 million additional BA and AA degrees by 2020. Well, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen by any stretch of the imagination. And if you look at a state like California, I think we have real disjunctures in our ability to produce a talent for the labor pool. Obviously, the labor pool does move around. I would say California has been working on a model over the last 20-plus years, definitely, but more so, and that's why you're seeing so much of its the tech world here in Washington, D.C., lobbying on the immigration side of the fence, is that we've been dependent partially on having talented immigrants come to our universities and then or otherwise being integrated into our labor pool. That's an important component to California's ongoing economic competitiveness.
And, you know, before we move on, it's just like, you know, we're talking about California as an example for a variety of reasons, which we've tried to get across. But, you know, state higher ed, the story is similar in other places. The scale is a little bit different. But, you know, I think the only states that are actually putting more money into their state higher education systems are states like North Dakota, which is doing so on the back of energy money, which not every state certainly can lay claim to. Dr. Goldrick-Robb, I was hoping that, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the effects on state higher ed and on the states themselves, or a state, but, you know, a system is made up of people, and in this case, a lot of your work has involved looking at students and families, and I'm curious about how you see students and families weathering these education support cutbacks. And what worries you about this situation?
Okay, well, thanks for the question. I actually wanted to first ask the audience a quick question, which is, how many of you in the room went to college? Okay, and how many of you have a child or grandchild or sister or brother who wants to go to college? Yeah, so the thing is, I think the answer to that question has to start with the fact that we're at a pretty historic moment in the history of this country. You know, at the start of the 20th century, we moved from a nation where most people didn't go to high school to a time in which it became really important that that we understand that free high school was going to be essential to the growth of the nation. And we're at a moment now where most of the country has come to the realization that having a stable life, a secure life, I'm not talking about being a millionaire. That dream is gone for most folks in light of the income inequality and the way in which the distribution of resources is going. But people want to go to college. So what's happening to students and families is really that they have very deep investments in the dream of college attendance, and they don't all mean Harvard. Most of them don't mean Harvard, frankly. They don't harbor these ideas that they're going to end up at one of the top 25 or top 100 institutions. There are almost 6,000 institutions of higher education in this country, and they want to participate in some way, shape, or form. And what they're finding is that the rhetoric that we have developed over the last 40 years or so, a rhetoric that says that we make college affordable and accessible to the masses, hasn't been matched by any real public policy commitment to make that possible. We made a series of decisions in the late 1960s and early 1970s where for about 5 years we said, you know, we are going to open the doors to everyone by adding a Pell Grant, for example, that would cover some of the costs of life while the poorest folks went to college. At the time, we had a very low tuition system, right? The costs of tuition and fees were low, and what we were doing was covering the opportunity costs for the poorest citizens so that they could afford to attend college the way that other folks were able to go when their parents covered, you know, their costs of room and board. Not long after that, we experienced a major shift, and it has everything to do with student loans. At the time, there were conversations about the relative public and private benefits of higher education and about the fact that it sort of looked like most of the benefits of higher education accrued privately, right? That individuals and their families got these things. And so as a result, we went towards a system where most of the burden is, in fact, carried by students and their families. Again, when this started at the time, more than two-thirds, as much as three-quarters of all of the costs of higher education were carried by through taxpayer assistance to the government, and the government was redistributing, and we were all sort of carrying the burden collectively with only a little bit on our own shoulders. The lack of public discussion about the benefits of higher education, and in particular about the public benefits of higher education, and our failure to quantify those benefits at a time when quantification has mattered more to us than anything. If you can't attach a number to it, it doesn't seem to exist now. That fact has led the government and the public to experience a massive, seemingly unchecked and undiscussed shift to the point now where about 75% of the costs of higher education are borne by individual students and their families, mainly in the form of student loans. So it might surprise some of you to know that even though what you hear is we've increased investment in the Pell Grants, and we have, and I'll give the Obama administration credit for that, and you hear that the poorest people get the most money, which they do, the fact of the matter is that that money is incredibly insufficient in light of the unchecked increases in the costs of higher education. So today, the poorest families are asked to contribute as much as 70% of their annual income to attend a public institution. 70%. Okay? They may get the most money, but the middle, and particularly upper middle class and the wealthiest, are asked to contribute far less than even 10 or even 5%. So this disproportionate burden is helping to contribute to a massive pulling apart within higher education that is going to ensure that the income inequality that we're all experiencing the results of right now continues. We're doing all of this under the pretense that we've opened doors and we've expanded access and that we've created a culture of affordability, when in fact we've fooled ourselves for 40 years now by using a means-tested system that's reliant on redistribution. The redistribution process for this, it's known as the FAFSA. Have any of you experienced the FAFSA? You'll never forget it. Okay, it's harder than filling out a tax form. It's a cruel joke, because what it says is, if you meet our criteria, and frankly most of the middle class doesn't, even though they too are experiencing real declines in family income, debt isn't counted in this means-tested system, right? So if you've been out of work for 5 years and now you suddenly get a job, what happens to your undergraduate? She loses her financial aid. She's not happy you got a job. She's devastated, and she drops out of college. So my work over the last 5 years studying the lives of Pell Grant recipients in this age of austerity suggests utter devastation for these folks. We're in putting in money that is so woefully inefficient that we're not getting a return on our investment, because what we're getting are students who attempt college, accrue debt, and don't complete, and are going to enter their 30s and 40s and 50s not only with debt, but with an incredible sense of failure at having tried to live up to the American dream and failed. If you visit community college campuses and increasingly public four-year institutions, you'd be stunned, because poor people go to college now, really poor people. I have visited colleges where one of the major issues in their classrooms are the homeless students. Homeless people are attending college. They're not finishing college. They want to get out. These are students who have food insecurity, who have no place to sleep. They have no place to keep their books at night. And our governments are redirecting money away from financing their public opportunities and towards incentivizing the growth of for-profit and even growth of private institutions, because they're cutting their seats and they're cutting their resources and they're making them places that are no longer desirable to even be. And it makes the private and for-profit institutions look good because in contrast, they have resources, they have endowments, they have, you know, they have resources they've generated off of our federal Pell Grant. We're going to be paying for this for a very, very long time. I think this is going to be the generation of people who are suffering from having bought into the American dream of college and learned that it was a joke. And what they're going to do with their own children in terms of what they're going to encourage them to do. And the fact is they're going to still be dealing with the long-term effects of student loan debt when their own kids are trying to go to college. This is an incredible passing of the buck from a generation, I think, that got some wonderful benefits from our government, enjoyed quite a bit of prosperity, and is now saddling children and grandchildren with a very different future.
Thank you. Ms. Smith, I'm especially interested to hear from you on this particular topic because you can speak to a certain extent to two forces that have the potential to change some things here. Having come out of the federal government, where, you know, as Dr. Douglas points out, state policy and state money is really the thing that drives public higher education. But the federal government does have some levers it can pull. And now you're in the foundation world, and Lumina is one of a number of foundations, including the Gates Foundation, that is making some significant attempts to affect higher education and higher education policy at a number of levels. What do you think are some of the options here from both of those sectors?
Well, I also want to thank you all for having me, and a disclaimer in advance, although Sarah's discussion thus far was kind of painting a grim picture. I'm not crying. I have allergies, so please excuse me throughout this. That said, I think both of our panelists have set things up quite well, because one of the first things that we dealt with in 2009 when I started working in the Department of Education in the Obama administration was obviously the global and really, from our perspective, the national recession, and how are we going to get out of that? What were we going to do? And actually, there was a large, obviously, there was the stimulus plan, which had the largest influx of federal money for education that we've ever seen, and not just in relative terms, like after taking account for inflation and all of that. We had $100 billion go to states for education to try to stave off cuts at the state level. And right. That money, some of it was used for the state fiscal stabilization fund, which could be used for both higher education and K-12. There's some, I won't say controversy, but states had some flexibility in where they decided to spend that money. So sometimes they kind of, you know, leaned heavy on the K-12 side and left the higher education folks out to dry. Right. But for by any account, it staved off what would have been much larger cuts in state budgets in that time. That said, you know, ARRA was, it was interesting because afterwards, it was like somewhere around 2010, 2011, everybody deemed that ARRA hadn't worked. And it's like, from my perspective in higher education and K-12 education, had this not happened, it would have been far worse than what we've seen.
Right.
And so that's just interesting. As in retrospect, maybe the history books will kind of write that wrong at some point. But what we did see after that happened was a decline in state higher education spending quite drastically after they no longer had the federal coffers from the state fiscal stabilization fund. And so there's questions about how does the federal government help states in the long term for some of these challenges. The state budgets aren't going to come back to where they were, or even if they do and they have different priorities, how does the federal government try to use its resources well in partnering with states?
Right.
I think Dr. Douglas was absolutely right. One of the things that we're struggling with now is that the federal government, President Obama in particular, is interested in increased higher education attainment. And it's really hard to get there if you have the largest population of individuals who need that increased attainment. You don't get increased attainment from people that are already going to college. And people that are wealthy, by and large, are already going to college. So the people who you need to help are the people who do not have the resources to go to college. Federal government has a Pell Grant. It has student loans. But it is not the largest determinant in college affordability. State governments are by far the largest determinant in whether college is affordable, both in their own financial aid programs that they have in the state, but probably more importantly, in their ability to determine what the tuition is at different colleges and universities, either directly or through the amount of subsidy that they provide. And what you've seen, as Dr. Goldrick-Robb described, is that there's a cost shifting going on, and it's been going on somewhat precipitously over the past couple of years, but from states to individuals. And so tuition is going up at public colleges and universities. Tuition is going up everywhere, but in particular, when you look at the percentage increase, it's been larger at public colleges and universities, and it's kind of widely agreed that the main reason for that is state cutbacks in higher education. And so when you try to think about that angle, how do you prevent tuition from continuing to increase? A lot of times the pressure goes to the leaders of the colleges and universities, so public college presidents and things like that, and I'm not a defender of college presidents by any mean, but you know, I think there were several incidences in California in particular where students like stormed the president's office. Well, the CSUs and the, you know, they don't have the actual ability to set the tuition at the college anyway. They're kind of dealing with what the state has provided. So you've got a bunch of dynamics that I think the federal government has to grapple with if it really wants to have an impact on college affordability. Simply increasing the Pell Grant year after year without a serious conversation about how you engage the states in affordability. It was interesting to hear the earlier conversation about Medicare. Well, they talked about Medicaid, but also about Medicare and how do you ensure some type of if you think higher education is very important, some type of entitlement of that nature for individuals at a certain price point to make it affordable if it's something that they really need in their lives, and you can't really do that in a fragmented way in a system like this where the vast majority of individuals are using the public system of higher education. So that's one piece from the federal angle, and I think President Obama and the administration were very cognizant of not only the state role, but also the fact that higher education is really important in the long-term future. So this 2020 goal, the idea that we want to be first in the world proportion of our adults that have post-secondary degrees, it wasn't just the fact that people are going back to college when the economy is bad. It is that when the economy gets better, the jobs that are there will require some form of post-secondary education. So you Yeah. want to make sure that people actually have the opportunity. If you believe in social mobility, and if you actually believe that that is possible, it's going to be necessary to provide some type of post-secondary education and make sure that it's accessible. And so in the long, not only the short term, providing that capacity because the roles are swelling at community colleges, et cetera, but also for the long-term stability of the nation, it's really important. I think that's all something that was realized. How you do that post-state fiscal stabilization fund, post-ARA, I think it's yet to be determined. How do you have a lasting commitment with states? I think there have been several proposals for race to the top for higher education, for college access and completion grants with states that do X, Y, and Z to give them money in exchange for, you know, the commitments on the state end. None of those has really come to fruition. We're talking about, you know, the age of austerity. Anything that requires new investment, especially new large investment that, you know, from Congress post-stimulus days is really a difficult sell. And particularly with states, something that wasn't mentioned is they have the unique ability to continue to, if you're a state and you're trying to figure out your state legislature, you're trying to figure out your budget, you've got your public college and universities, which need to be funded. You've got your K-12 system. You've got your, you know, firefighters. You've got, you know, whatever else, the main public safety. You've got your prisons. The only one of those that has an external arm for collecting revenue is the public colleges and universities because they can always raise tuition. So that has been the easy thing to do. It's been easy to say, well, we've got to spend money on, we would love to do more on pre-K, so we're going to do that there. You can't charge five-year-olds, you know, $5,000 a year. I mean, I guess you could. That might be next. But, you know, that's not really the system we have. So we're going to expand these other areas. We have to, you know, fund the prisons. We have to fund the public health. We have to fund our commitment, our state commitment to the healthcare system, especially under Obamacare. And so there's all these other pressures. And if you go to states, this is what they will tell you. The president went to the National Governors Association several times and was constantly the rebuff that he got when he said, we need you to have this kind of commitment, the bully pulpit, like, okay, I don't have anything to hold you to this, but I really, really want you to invest. And they would say, well, you've got the Obamacare and you've got this and we've got to do all these other things. How do you expect us to do this, especially when we don't have the ability in our states to run deficits like you do at the federal level? We've got to balance our budget every year. And it's easy to do that on the backs of public higher education because we can just increase tuition. So I think that's still a dilemma. To kind of wrap this up, in my role at the Lumina Foundation, it's been a little bit freeing because although my focus is on student financing, obviously I come from this from the perspective that you cannot think about student financing in the absence of thinking about the state role. You're just kind of fooling yourself if you think that reforming student loans is going to get rid of the problem of college affordability alone. So one of the first things we're doing is trying to figure out how we can are there some interesting ideas about how you engage states? I don't think you have it yet. I don't think you have the answer. But we are also looking at whether there is a role for maybe a federal-state partnership for aid or what should states be doing. I think one of the questions that we actually get from a lot of states as a foundation, we do a lot of work with various states, is how can they be better using their resources? So they say we're not going to have any more money. But we're Georgia, and I'm from Atlanta originally. We have a Georgia Hope Scholarship Program, which, if you don't know, provides free public college tuition to anyone that graduates from high school with a B average or better. It's a lottery scholarship program. Several other states modeled their lottery scholarships after the Georgia Hope program. I won't go into the policy merits of Georgia Hope, but they're running out of money. They're not able to provide the same benefit that they have, and they're questioning, is there a better way, a more efficient way? So one of the questions we have is, well, if the people who wouldn't otherwise go to college are those who are lower income, does it make sense for someone like my sister, who's both of her parents went to college? We weren't rich, but Georgia Tech, where she went, is a great college. She ended up paying... What did she pay? She worked through college and maybe paid $1,000 out of her own money through 5 years. This is Georgia Tech, 5 years it took her to graduate. She got a job right out of college working at ExxonMobil, making big bucks and paid nothing for it. Meanwhile, neighbors whose first-generation college students, parents laid off, need to scrape up money because when they graduated from high school, they maybe had a 3.0, but when their first year at Clayton State, they dropped down to a 2.8, lost the whole Hope Scholarship. Now you've got to pay the tuition at Clayton State because Hope Scholarship doesn't have any second chances built into something like that. Is that the most efficient use of state resources? Is that the best way to help more residents of your state go to college? Probably not. So we're trying to think about some advice that we can provide to states on that front.
I think that's an excellent point. Thank you. And on the way here, I actually, and sorry, this is a little bit of a plug. My colleague Jeff Salengo wrote a piece this week that talked about a program at Georgia State that basically targets students who are getting ready to get kicked out of school because they can't pay their tuition. They're in some way overdue. And what they found by looking at the data was, in a lot of cases, these are students with good grades. These were students who were maybe, a semester or a quarter from graduating and couldn't come up with $500 to cover the expense of their last semester. And by, a relatively small amount of money used in a very targeted way, they made a huge difference in these students' lives and as a carry-through benefit also made a difference in their graduation rates. So, certainly... you talk to anyone in U.S. higher ed, and they will tell you they could use more money. But all the solutions that might help don't have to be expensive solutions. I was going to ask some follow-up questions, but frankly, I think I would like to go ahead to the audience so we can get some questions in. Sorry. Yes, in the back.
Hi, I appreciate the conversation, and I want to add another player. You talk about affordability, but we haven't talked about accountability. And I hate to think of colleges and universities as a black hole where, and I don't know the dynamics, but you look at the salaries of college presidents, you look at the loss on college sports, and I'm wondering, what do we want to pay for
and what are we getting for our investment? And I think we don't have a good match, and I think that needs to be part of the conversation.
That was going to be the first follow-up question I asked. Would someone like to address that?
Absolutely, we do need more accountability, and right now I would frankly say most accountability structures at the state level are kind of an accounting, you know, like did you get so many degrees and these kinds of things. But I want to also note to you that there's, I think, a lot of not well understood dynamics to higher education finances. And again, you have to really disaggregate the different kinds of institutions. So when you talk about, oh, the athletic programs and these presidents that make a lot of money, we're talking about a very small grouping. And college presidents, I don't want them to make a bunch of money, but in the overall scheme of things, it's more symbolic than an actual, you know, financial drain on the institution. But just to give you an example, so if you look at the actual costs of undergraduate education at the University of California, a lot of methodological problems, okay, but there have been agreements on certain costs. It costs about $16,000 for an undergraduate to go to Berkeley. That's the operational education, the cost of the institution to educate that student as assessed by a methodology that has lots of problems because universities and colleges work on a revenue sharing structure. All right, what does it cost to educate a high school student in the state of New York? $16,000. What's the range at the K-12 level? I'm only putting it comparative. I'm not saying that this is the right number or whatever. Its range is $10,000 to $16,000 in the U.S. for educating a high school student. So, and that cost at QC has been going down 19-20% over the last 10 years. Why? Partly because student to faculty ratios are being pushed up. We're up to 23-1. This is one of the major universities in the U.S. in the world, and we're having astronomical cost efficiencies, which relate to very real internal structural changes. So then if you go to a CSU, it's about $10,000. If you go to a community college, it's about $5,000 or $6,000. I think it's way too low. And so the cost elements are real. The question is, what does it cost to actually educate a student versus the cost to students and then the various effects? And so I think we have to unpack this some and think more broadly. So I'll give you one final thing and then go to my companions here on the panel, is that, you know, tuition can be too high and it can be too low. And the example is perfect for California's community colleges. We have the lowest community college fees in the U.S., which also means we miss out on some financial aid, which is really stupid. But the politics related to fees is very complex, very emotional.
Fees, not tuition, right?
Yeah, sorry, fees and tuition. So if you went to the national average, what would be the impact in California? Well, I don't know for sure. We need to do work on this kind of thing. I think there would be some disproportional effects on lower-income students. I'd be very concerned about that. But then again, maybe not, because then maybe those 250,000 students that were not able to get into the system would then be able to get into it with the certain financial aid structures. So we're stuck on an old model about financing, and we keep going back to it. It's gone, and we have to create a new model, and it's not – a silver bullet is not there. It has to be a combination of things that are going on, and I won't talk any more about that.
We have a huge issue with costs. I'm going to completely agree with that. And I think that the issue is partly driven by the way in which we've done the financing. I will also agree with that. I think that it is remarkable that California even has any estimate of the actual cost of educating a student, because most colleges and universities will tell you they don't know the actual cost. They know what they charge, right? And they do it by legacy. And it's a rather stunning thing to look at a vice chancellor for administration in the eye at a university and say, what does it cost per year? And have him say, I've never been asked that question. Okay? So
they
know what they spend, and they spend by legacy. What they got last year, it's called cost to continue, right? We just keep going. There is no science underneath these costs. We do not know what the effects of class size are
for these students. We have lots of discussion about this at K-12, and we can say, obviously, we don't want to put a six-year-old who also has to be watched, right? And there's safety issues in classrooms that are too large, right? We know that it's hard to triage and to deal with heterogeneous groupings at that age. We have no such evidence on this in higher education. We do know that sometimes it doesn't go as well, partly because our faculty, for the most part, have also had grossly insufficient professional development to learn how to manage classes of different sizes and to learn about how to deal with the incredible heterogeneity in the student body that is increasing. Now, certainly I'm not saying faculty don't teach. That's a myth perpetuated by the public research institutions and the private elite schools. But most of my colleagues throughout higher education teach a lot, but they don't get lots of time for professional development. There's a lot of ways in which these costs could be lowered, but not within the current structure. Well, the way that we think about this is that if costs are lowered, all the colleges and universities will get is less revenue. That's providing very little incentive for them to do this. I don't want to see the colleges, even the community colleges at California, shift to increasing their tuition in order to redistribute it through financial aid. If they can deal with their cost issues and convince us that they know what they need to do a good job, we should fund them. We have to fix the tax structure, and we need to fund them appropriately so that what we don't continue to do is create a growing disparities among students on a given college campus. Everybody can manage to pay the tuition and fees, perhaps, because we've offset it with some financial aid, but they cannot fully participate in college life. Right? Just as in high schools right now, some kids are going to the prom and other ones aren't. Right? Because they can't afford to opt into that quote-unquote experience. Maybe you don't care about that. Maybe you care about whether or not they can participate in the laboratory activities, right, associated with some classes, or purchase the books for their class rather than just sit in the classroom. There are haves and have-nots on these college campuses, and it's creating major disparities in the experiences. The last thing I want to say is with regard to these presidential salaries. Yes, the fact of high presidential salaries or high faculty salaries or athletic spending or dorms may only happen at a segment of institutions, but they have very real effects on all of the other institutions because of peer effects. And this race that even places like UW Parkside and Stout and these superior, right, these are our state branch campuses, not branch campuses, but our state comprehensives. The fact that students now come to their schools thinking they're supposed to look like these other schools, the fact that a college president would feel badly accepting a salary of less than $500,000 a year at UW-Madison has everything to do with what her counterpart makes at Yale. That's a huge issue. The fact that it's become acceptable to, you know, pay $400,000 for a business professor at an institution because there's some market demand for him in the private sector, and yet he teaches nothing at an institution. The fact that we have acceded to those demands, that's a problem. So I think that if you're going to stand up for families and students, you can't stand behind the administrations of these places. I think they're not being held accountable. The state should be held accountable, too. But we can't pretend like this is working for the faculty or staff either, nor is it working for students and families.
Just as someone who covers, oversees state higher ed coverage, this is a huge issue, accountability at the state level. Not necessarily across the board in every state, but a number of states, the legislature being very proactive about demanding more information, more accountability, more oversight, in some cases, over state higher ed. And, you know, the jury is still out in many of these cases on whether or not that's going to be effective oversight. But they are certainly, state higher ed and accountability has their attention. In terms of higher education buzzwords, I would put accountability right below MOOC, which is number one, and ROI. But it's number three with a bullet. Is there another question? Yes.
I'm wondering what approaches you're considering seriously to try to deal with the cutbacks in state budgets. obviously you don't want to grow the, in the for-profit institutions. They have terrible graduation rates. Student debt levels are high. But many have thought about working with the private sector at the community college level to create skills that the private sector really need, and it might be a more focused approach. Do you see that as offering an opportunity?
I'm into the all above solution. I think there are many different things that can be done. Community colleges should be doing and have had a historical role of being linked to local regional economies and businesses. It's right. Just that, you know, they've been distracted sometimes by other things that they're doing. You know, one might argue that with the, you know, half the community college students in California should be intended to transfer to the BA level degree programs. So there's a lot of mission difficulties. But I would say that, yes, absolutely, looking a bit at the German model, like the Hochschulen, and having stronger links with local businesses in terms of technical fields, absolutely. And there are private, for-profit companies that can help develop curriculum, absolutely. Those are all, I think, real potentials. But, you know, I will make one quick comment on the role of MOOCs and online. So another question is, well, one of the things that's come up in California is, well, we can't provide the courses because we don't have enough faculty. But by the way, 70% of the faculty at the community colleges are part-time faculty. 70% of the students are part-time. I'll come back. I would like to say something about part-time students because this is a huge macro problem in the U.S. that not many people seem to understand. But these online courses and these kinds of things can be integrated, and I think the for-profits have a role in every state. The problem is quality, and then where does it really fit? And I think a lot of exaggeration and a lack of knowledge about the research in the field. So to give you an example, we know that 18 to 24-year-olds that go purely on an online program and course, I mean, it may change, the technology may change, have attrition rates through the roof. Mm-hmm. We're talking the University of Phoenix online education program, purely online, has a completion rate of something nobody quite knows because the privates don't like to give data, of maybe 4%. The MOOCs right now, if you look at them, have about a completion rate of 7%. They aren't linked to, you know, degrees. There's other economic problems with the model thus far. And when you look at those 7%, they're a very distinct kind of people. They're very driven. They're, you know, they're a certain kind. So. There's a real role for online education, but I think it's not the kind of solution that people think it is as a way to break up bottleneck courses and these kinds of things. The real, just the other factoid is that if you looked at 18 to 24-year-olds, their behavior patterns on purely, like say, an individual online course or a fully online course is very different than a 29, 32-year-old professional wanting a degree. And so my view is that in many of these places, including community colleges, there should be more online courses, absolutely, or at UC. But you've got to be really careful as to what really you're doing. And really the solution going forward is more of a hybrid flip courses, these kinds of integrating more. It's already integrated. We don't even know how much it is. Nobody has a good track on that. Is more about that. Now, when you look at that, is that cost efficiency or is it better pedagogy? You know, and what's our value? I'll tell you, it may not be cheaper. It may not be cheaper, but I'm sorry I digressed from your original question, but I think for-profits, I don't mean to be anti-for-profit. I think there are certain sectors that are very useful, but there's a lot of abuse. There's a huge problem with many of the players.
I would actually connect this question about what people can do better to the question about accountability. So we kind of talked about state-level accountability and kind of public accountability in general. But a very serious question because of the federal budget conversations is about federal accountability of colleges and universities. There is what I would call a minimal level, a very, very low bar for what we will accept in terms of being too fraudulent. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I think it's 35% of your students default on their student loans after 3 years now, then we will put you on probation. That is an extremely high default rate. And we've learned that people basically know how to game default rates for student loans because it's not a lifetime default rate. It's who defaulted within this period. We now have income-based repayment, which is if you don't make any money, you don't have to pay anything. So if you can tell your students that they could be in income-based repayment, I don't know that it's successful if they're not in default because we haven't, you know, started sending collection agencies after them. But the fact that they were not able to utilize their education to get a paying job in large numbers, not on an individual basis or somebody that decided to do AmeriCorps, but like the vast majority of your students can't get jobs, it seems problematic. And so I would say I don't want to get into a really, really controversial thing, but the Obama administration did look at this question of accountability, particularly as it relates to the for-profit sector, although it had implications for the entire higher education community. And I don't think the question is going away, not just from the Obama administration, but just generally with federal policymakers being asked to invest more. A Pell Grant can be used, it's essentially a voucher. So you can use a Pell Grant at University of Phoenix, just like you can use it at University of California, Berkeley, just like you can use it at University of Wisconsin-Madison, just like you can use it at, you know, Georgia Tech. And we don't help students very well determine whether that is a good investment at those various places. And then on the flip side, we provide no incentive for the colleges to try to be a better quality or place for that student trying to look to where to use that voucher. The other thing is just from an investment perspective as the state, right, as the public, do we think that the Pell Grant is best used at any one of those places, or do we think that we should make some in having limited resources in the same way that the state of Georgia needs to think about who the best students are to invest their state scholarship program in. Do we think that all the institutions are created equal with regard to how well they are using our resources? And I think that question will continue to come up over the next several years.
I just want to add, piggybacking on that. Look, I mean, we really abdicated our responsibility here. And when we made the decision that aid should flow directly to students rather than institutions. And we did it based on faith in the market, right? We thought that, I mean, there were two things were going on. The private institutions were the bedrock of higher education way back in the day, right? Before we, especially the federal government, got involved in growing a community college sector, the state governments as well, very importantly for the community colleges in particular, but before we really started to make these massive investments in our public institutions, you know, it was the case that the private schools were quite important. That has really changed, right? And yet the private institutions have this extraordinarily, extraordinarily successful lobby. And they were lobbying very hard at the time when our financial aid policies were put into place because they were very concerned about their revenue and their enrollments, and they succeeded in making it the case that the Pell Grant could be taken anywhere because how dare they be cut out of a system, right? But the fact is that we therefore support, in the name of choice, students to take their vouchers wherever they want, now including the very vibrant for-profit industry, and I'm far more concerned about this when it comes to student loans. Because it is very, very clear from evidence that these institutions are setting their prices based on the loan availability. Now, nobody on the left or the right is excited about the idea of yanking resources away from families that they're currently reliant on to finance education. But that also has to come to terms with the fact that it is probably the case. And this is something that, you know, I appreciated that Tyler Cohen was admitting that he's rethought things in the last year. I've been doing a lot of thinking about the Bennett hypothesis, the hypothesis that, in fact, our federal financial aid is propping up the costs of some colleges and universities. It's not true for all of them. This is not happening at the community colleges, you know, frankly, because their commitment to low costs has remained extremely strong for a very long period of time, and only when the states, you know, pull the rug out from under them do they ever turn to tuition. But other institutions clearly see loans and aid as a piggy bank, just like states see colleges and universities and the families as an ATM that they can turn to for tuition. And if we did something about those loans and made them less available. If we had high voter participation in this country, and that's another major problem, if they turned to their states and said, no, we're not going to take out loans, we're not going to carry this on our backs, it's time to appropriate the resources. And because the share of users today of higher education, right, is a much larger fraction than it used to be. It used to be that you're asking your neighbors to pay for your kid to go to college. We're all trying to go to college now. Right? Now it's really a system that would be much better financed through taxes. We can drive these loans down, and it can be only the people who want to borrow to go to Harvard, right, who will invest in those loans and make that choice, and that's fine for them because it represents almost nothing of their family income. And by the way, Harvard and Stanford will still invest in bringing poor kids to their college because they believe in diversity the same way that private high schools already do.
Unfortunately, I think we're out of time. I'd like to thank the panelists. I'd like to thank Brookings, and thank you for your attention.
That's good. Thank you. That's fun. Yes.
It's part of it's going to be the AI chapter. Okay. It is. I mean, Andrew's. Yeah, I know. It's coming to you. It's coming. I have to finish my AI chapter first. Yeah, Andrew read it, though.
Yeah. Well, if I told you, I understand. And I mean, there are, when we're talking again, disaggregated for-profit sector.
Are you a committee?
You know,
or?
Loan
okay,
through
great.
The roof,
I just testified.
The roof. You know, it's all about making money, or a lot of them, at least, a fair amount. And then I said, okay, it costs $16,000 to send a student to one of the most prestigious public universities in the world. Relatively speaking to other costs, maybe we can drive it down to 14 or 12. And how do we do that? Well, we'll make we have a really cost-efficient model. It's called large classrooms. And in fact, it could be more efficient than MOOCs in terms of actual people getting through. We don't know. But if I said, okay, we'll just jack up the student to faculty ratios and we'll make it 12K, are you going to be happy with that? Is that cheap enough?
Yeah.
Well, I think that we're already at the border. Yeah, it was really nice.
Hi, everyone. We're going to get started in just a few seconds here. If you all want to take your seats, and we'll get going in just a few minutes. Great. Well, good morning, everyone. And it's hard to be the last panel between the morning and lunchtime. So we'll try and keep our remarks very lively and entertaining and have you guys out of here in relatively short order. My name is Sarah Cliff. I'm a reporter with The Washington Post, where I write about all things health policy, Affordable Care Act, Medicare and Medicaid, and a lot of it, as of late, is focused on budget cutting and reducing health care costs, which, as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, have been, up until recently, growing quite quickly. We have a great panel here. Directly to my left is Shama Gomkar, who's an associate professor of public affairs at the University of Texas. We have Jonathan Oberlander, professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina. And all the way at the end is Laura Olson, who's a professor of political science at Lehigh University. And I'm not going to spend too much time talking because they all have a great research background and a lot to talk about. A few things, you know, I just wanted to mention to set the stage. You know, right now, healthcare is one of both our government's and our economy's biggest spending items. In 2011, we spent $2.7 trillion on healthcare. About one-fifth of our overall economy is going towards healthcare. And that works out to about $8,680 a person, which is generally more than all other countries. And when we talk about healthcare and government policy, it's hard for me to think of times when we talk about how to increase spending. I guess the Affordable Care Act has been a bit of an anomaly on that front, but usually we're talking about how to reduce spending on Medicare, Medicaid, and other programs. So I guess I want to open it up to you all for some opening remarks on kind of how you see austerity discussions, how they affect healthcare programs. And I know you all kind of look at different areas in your research, but what it means to talk about health policy in an era of austerity.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, the Brookings, for inviting me, and delighted to be with two of my colleagues here. I think it's on. I'll catch up with my. It's an interesting time, and I think kind of being the best of time and now getting to be the worst of time. But healthcare really has had a long history of growing spending and what is now being termed as an unsustainable rate of growth of spending. And the reforms really are targeting that feature first and then internally improving the workings of the system. I think the two main goals are, and these are the goals of the Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, is to expand the coverage and bring more people under health insurance policies. And the second is to reduce costs. And I think both these are, at the present moment, in some way affected by austerity. Healthcare in general hasn't really been affected directly, the major programs, Medicare and Medicaid, by the sequester. But overall, the impacts of the natural demographic forces and the way the industry is functioning has definitely grown the spending so substantially that irrespective of austerity, we need to be cutting back. The latest development, the not so latest anymore, last year, the Supreme Court decision to provide the federal government the right to impose an individual mandate as well as enforce it, has significantly changed the way in which the healthcare will function in this country. We will have close to universal coverage as a result of that decision. And that goal of healthcare seems to be very achievable. But what it does is it actually expands the demand for healthcare services substantially. And if nothing really happens on the supply side, prices will go up, and that's the law of markets. And under most people's expectation, expenditure will go up as well. In other words, people will keep spending close to what they are currently on their healthcare, irrespective of growing prices. So the demand side in terms of the impact of recent developments has been significantly enhanced or boosted. Austerity is having some impact, not kind of a direct impact, but an indirect impact on the demand side. It's expanding demand primarily on the public health programs, I would expect, because of the cutbacks that are being done in not directly Medicare and Medicaid, because these are off the table in some sense currently. Medicare, there are some provisions of reducing the payments to providers, which actually affects supply, which adds to the problem in some sense of price increase in healthcare. But the indirect effects are going to come through the reductions in public health programs, the reduction in a whole range of programs that affect lower income individuals, ranging from housing to vaccination and such like. So on the demand side, there is going to be some impact on the healthcare and the healthcare reforms, et cetera. But the real problem that austerity creates is probably on the supply side. And the picture seems to be very positive on the supply side at the present moment. We have had some recent estimates from the Congressional Budget Office suggesting that healthcare spending is actually below its projected levels, and it seems to be somewhat more sustainable in that per capita spending is growing at about the rate that our GDP is growing currently. So there is a bit of optimism on the supply side in that the cost of providing these services seems to be under control in some measure. What is the reason for this immediate optimism that has arisen due to this data? Some of it could be, and there's some talk of this, just a matter of number juggling assumptions made by the Congressional Budget Office. But there's some research that shows that there is some real results of the research and changes being made in the industry over the last couple of years, including the health reforms that are taking place. There are improvements in the organization of the delivery of care, et cetera. So there is some ground for cautious optimism that we might be able to contain this beast without actually cutting back on the healthcare services we provide while trying to increase access to them. But it is a cautious optimism, and I think the role of austerity in all this is the piece that calls for us to be cautious. Austerity seems to be having some impact, but it looks like the impact, and to borrow a term from Brookings, in terms of bending the curve, I think its role in bending the cost curve of healthcare is really not necessarily a positive thing. It seems to be a lot of the impact it's having is through cost shifting. And the cost shifting is taking different forms. The federal government, which is under cutbacks, as I said, a lot of them are not affecting the major healthcare programs, but to some extent they are, is shifting costs to the states. States, on the other hand, are actually very major players in the public health programs and in the related programs that affect these public health programs, which are the discretionary non-defense spending programs. And the role of states has been pretty much affected by austerity and the budget problems that they're experiencing in terms of how much money they can provide to improve the functioning of these programs and to boost the supply when the demand is increasing through improved rates of returns given to providers and in the, within the public health system. So there's an element of constraint that the state governments are experiencing that is pushing them to shift the cost further, and I think the ultimate cost shifting is happening at the cost of, in some sense, the individual, the enrollee. And so we're really, the impact of austerity is really in the nature of cost shifting rather than immediate improvements in efficiency and the working of the healthcare system. I also think that the reforms that have happened recently are probably moving us in some way in the right direction on the supply side. They are creating what already exists, and that is a kind of a tiered system. They are formalizing what already exists is a tiered system of healthcare where you get some basic health, and then you can purchase, more platinum kind of healthcare programs or insurance schemes through your private resources. So there's an element of tiered healthcare system that is being introduced, and I think in some ways austerity might help us move more in that direction, and that would be probably a good thing to happen.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back here. I was a graduate student here 20 years ago, so time flies. Austerity is a strange concept in healthcare. Nearly one out of every $5 we spend in the American economy is on healthcare. And as a country, we spent almost $3 trillion this year on medical care. So we sort of, in health policy, we laugh at the word austerity. What do you mean austerity? If you go to a convention of hospital executives, they feel like Job. They will tell you, look, Medicare is going to cut our payments and private insurers are squeezing us. And, it's a real sob story. I often have my Kleenex to dab the tears. But then I get up and I say to them, can you name me another industry where you can tell me that we're going to spend over $35 trillion in the next decade, which is what we're projected to spend on medical care? So there, frankly, has not been a lot of austerity in healthcare in the United States, period. The second point I want to make on the slowdown, and we have seen this recent slowdown, a relative slowdown, in the rate of increase in healthcare spending, and there's a sort of ongoing discussion about whether this slowdown is permanent. And which is a strange thing to me. As I said, I used to live in Washington, and there are some things that I'm guessing even 20 years later are still here in Washington and indicate that there are permanent features of living in the Beltway. The summers are insufferably hot. If you have to take Amtrak on the weekend to New York, that's insufferable. Tourists don't know where to turn off on DuPont Circle. So these things are sort of permanent features of life. Healthcare spending is not permanent. Just because it's moderate for a few years doesn't mean you can throw a party and say we solved the problem. And so I suspect that we're all cautiously optimistic. I suspect we're going to need to do much more. The third point I want to make is about really austerity politics, meaning budget deficit politics. And there's no question that healthcare is a big target because it's so large. And the long-term deficit problem, many people will tell you, is a healthcare problem and nothing else, basically, on the spending side. And deficits transform health politics. They make reforms possible that are not in other times. And so it's not a bad thing to have a constraint on healthcare spending. What is a bad thing is to think just about the budget view. Because if you think of healthcare spending as a federal budget problem, you think of it solely in terms of Medicare and Medicaid and now the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. And the problem with that is that it's also a problem in the private sector. Medicare and Medicaid are big parts of the U.S. healthcare system, but that's not all there is. And healthcare spending is an issue for employers, for workers, and their families. And if we focus on this just and conceive of it just as a deficit problem, so we just want to reduce federal spending, then we come up with really bad ideas like raising the eligibility age in Medicare. Now, raising the eligibility age for Medicare is an idea that has had a lot of bipartisan support. At one time, even President Obama reportedly agreed, I don't know if it was on the golf course or not, with Speaker Boehner, agreed to this idea. He's since backed off. It has a lot of bipartisan support, but this is an example of a reform that is cost shifting rather than cost saving, because if we raise the eligibility age up to, say, 67 from where it is now at 65, it's not like 65 and 66-year-olds are going to move to Quebec or Toronto tomorrow. They're still going to be here. So we actually don't save any money. It's just the federal government saves money. Similarly, if we work to cap what the federal government reimburses states for Medicaid, that's not really going to save any money, to use the old Canadian saying. It's a strategy of shift and shaft. Shift the burden to the states, you then get shafted. So I think we have to be careful about thinking of this simply as a budget issue. The fourth point I want to make is a sunny, optimistic point, and that is healthcare spending is controllable. It is amenable to public policy. We know this. Now, I didn't bring a PowerPoint, A, because I'm morally opposed to PowerPoint, and B, because it didn't really fit. So you'll have to take my word, and people actually did speak pre-PowerPoint, so I think I can do this. But if I had a chart here and I showed you the per enrollee growth in Medicare spending above gross domestic product, the long-term trend is actually down, not up. And so when you hear that Medicare spending is out of control and you look at this chart, it doesn't really add up. And what that chart reflects is that we've made changes in Medicare in the past that have reduced spending. And we certainly can do it again. And so that's the good news. The fifth point is that I think the Affordable Care Act transforms the politics of cost control, and to the extent that it goes forward in all its glorious mess, what it does is it gives the government a stronger stake in controlling the politics of cost control of medical care, because if people are mandated to buy coverage and if the government is paying for subsidies, all of a sudden now there is a strong incentive to hold down spending. And I think, you know, the all-American formula of healthcare reform is enact expansions of coverage and don't do anything on cost control or fake the cost control or do a little bit. And I think the Affordable Care Act does some things on cost control. I suspect as we go forward over time, the natural political trajectory, as in Medicare, will be that it'll tighten up. The sixth point I would make is this, we talk a lot on the spending side in healthcare, and we shouldn't forget the revenue side. There are things we can do to reduce healthcare spending, but if you look at the projection of Medicare, back to Medicare, the projection of per capita Medicare spending growth over the next decade is pretty close to GDP growth. And, you know, healthcare historically is about 2.5 points higher than GDP, so when we get down to GDP growth, that's pretty extraordinary. Can we go a little lower? Maybe, probably not a lot lower. And we would do well to remember that we didn't get in the current deficit problem that we have because of healthcare spending. We got it because we cut taxes, because we had an extraordinary recession, and because we fought two wars without paying for them. So there's a little bit of a bait and switch on how we got the deficit and then saying we need to slash Medicare and Medicaid. Going forward, if the aging of the population, we're going to have more revenues. One way or another, we're going to have more revenues. And the last point I want to make is this. I think there's a tendency, having waited so long for a big expansion of coverage, having failed so many times, spending so much energy trying to figure out what it is we just did and trying to implement what we did in the Affordable Care Act, there's a tendency to say, okay, we've done the coverage, now let's focus on the cost. The reality is, even a decade from now, if you look at the forecast, we're still going to have over 30 million people in the United States who don't have any health insurance at all. And a lot of folks who have insurance, even under the Affordable Care Act, that's not very good. So I think one other potential effect we have to think about with deficits and austerity politics is what we'll do to coverage, and not to forget the coverage side, because we've taken a big step forward, but we sure have a lot more steps left.
Okay, thank you for being here. I'm one of those tourists who had trouble getting off at DuPont Circle, so I related to that. When I realized I would be dealing with the issue of healthcare and austerity, I started thinking about, well, how does austerity affect policymaking? My area of study right now is the Medicaid, the most hated and loved program in the United States. And I came up with a whole host of issues, so I'd like to just share some of them with you. The first thing is that over the recent decades, we've experienced both privatization and devolution, which means that what we did was we made policymaking for Medicaid at the state level. And Medicaid in the states have a very difficult history, because what that means is that when economic conditions get bad, you get more people eligible. At the same time, that's when state revenues go down. So the Great Recession of 2008, of course, made it very difficult for the states to deal with Medicaid. Medicaid already accounts for about 22% of overall state budgets and about a little over 14% of their own budgets, not counting what they get from the federal government. So what do you do when you give states the power to make these decisions in the age of austerity, and then you add the maintenance of effort requirements given by the Affordable Care Act, so you can't really cut eligibility, so what are you going to cut? So what the states have done, for the most part, is cut the scope of benefits, the so-called optional benefits. They've limited the kinds and amounts of drugs. They've added small co-payments, and they've mostly, because you get immediate economic benefits, have cut provider fees. So what that means is the beneficiaries, and I saw something recently that said Medicaid people are enrollees and Medicare are beneficiaries, which I liked. But the Medicaid enrollees essentially are having more and more trouble finding physicians, because provider cuts means that fewer and fewer physicians are willing to take care of them. So for Medicaid beneficiaries or enrollees, what you get is cuts in what they're getting. The second thing I thought was interesting is that austerity politics affected the Affordable Care Act overall in regarding Medicaid. I'm going to focus on Medicaid. Medicaid in the Affordable Care Act is supposed to take care of half of all the uncovered, insured people in the United States. Why didn't they give everybody subsidized insurance? The reason is that Medicaid is cheaper. And the Obama administration was determined to keep the Affordable Care Act under $1 trillion, so they turned to Medicaid, which is cheaper. Now, why is Medicaid cheaper? One of the major reasons is they pay providers much less than private insurance and much less than Medicare, which means that enrollees will have more and more trouble finding a doctor to take care of them. So in some sense, austerity politics in the Affordable Care Act has made it such that we have reinforced the two-class medical system in the United States, simply adding the working poor to the second-class medical system. The third thing that I thought is interesting in terms of how has austerity affected healthcare policy in Medicaid is the introduction of managed care, mandatory managed care in the recent decades. 74% of, and growing fast, of all Medicaid recipients are in managed care. They have no choice. I suspect few would choose it if they could. 100% of the new enrollees in the Affordable Care Act will be in managed care, and that simply reinforces the second class system, because managed care is notoriously in Medicaid. Stints on services, it's very difficult to find physicians, especially specialists, and all kinds of problems in these Medicaid-only managed care organizations. We have these managed care organizations that only serve Medicaid recipients, I think they fare a little better in the ones that serve private and Medicaid. The irony of all of the irony that I find is that while austerity politics has come to give fewer services, has made it harder on beneficiaries to get in Medicaid the kinds of things that they need, when the Democrats put together the Affordable Care Act itself, they weren't dealing with austerity politics at all. Because indeed, in order to, I'm a political scientist, in order to get the Affordable Care Act passed, they had to dispense with any concept of austerity politics. So they made deals with the drug companies, which essentially said there will not be any cost controls on drugs. They made deals with the insurance companies, which said we will not have a public option. We made deals with the hospitals, which said there won't be any cost controls on hospitals, and so on. So when it comes to the providers, the austerity politics did not come into play at all, which means that the Affordable Care Act itself will be extraordinarily costly unless somebody starts thinking seriously about cost controls. Okay. One thing that I've been hearing a lot about, and which Sarah had originally talked about, is the decrease in healthcare costs. I would like to point out, and I am much less optimistic than anybody else on this panel about that, because if you look at why healthcare costs are decreasing in Medicaid, I can come up with a whole host of reasons. One is that because of the imposition of small amounts of copays, the beneficiaries are using services less. The second reason is that because of lower provider fees, more doctors are pulling out, which means there are fewer services being used. In the case of Medicaid, and we were talking about long-term care at another one of these panels, long-term care is one-third of all Medicaid costs, and most of the money has gone into nursing homes, and increasingly what they're doing is moving from institutional care to home and community-based care, and that has lowered the costs. The good news is that people prefer home and community care. The bad news is that they don't get enough care to make up the difference. And I'll just give you a great example. My mother was supposed to go into a nursing home, and I know that there's diversion in Florida, and they said, oh, we will give her home and community care instead of nursing home care. And they gave us 10 hours of care. Clearly, that wasn't going to do it. She can't walk, she's blind, and she has Parkinson's disease. And this is going on throughout the country. So what they're doing is lowering costs, keeping the very frail elderly out of nursing homes, but putting the burden on families more and more. So there's a lot of cost shifting going there. And then the other reason that in Medicaid costs are going down is because of this ongoing shift to managed care, which means less services, less quality services, and so on. So I'm much less optimistic that the decrease in costs for health care means that the actual cost of health care is going down, which the data doesn't suggest, but rather the use of services and needed services are going down. Finally, what I'd like to add is that I find it kind of ironic or a self-fulfilling prophecy that now that we're watching the 50 states and whether they will, in fact, opt into Medicaid or not, one of the reasons the governors are arguing, Republican, this is clearly a partisan issue, All the Democratic governors are going in. All but eight of the Republican governors are opting out. The argument that the opting out Republican governors are making is that they don't trust Congress. They say that Congress is going to renege on the promise to pay 100% and then 90% of all the extension costs. The self-fulfilling prophecy part is that it's the Republican congressmen who are looking to cut the Medicaid up to $750 billion over 10 years. So the Republicans are doing exactly what the Republicans are fearing they will do. And this is clearly a problem for the opt-ins.
Great. Well, thank you all. That was a lot to go off of. One thing that you all touched on that I was hoping to hear a little bit more about is kind of this difference between cost saving and cost shifting that I think, as Jonathan mentioned, it's really easy if you take some seniors off Medicare, all of a sudden Medicare costs less, but you haven't really saved any money. And I think the Obama administration, at least when I talked to them, would argue that they have tried to do some things that are cost saving and not just cost shift. Cost shifting in the Affordable Care Act, such as accountable care organizations or penalizing hospitals for preventable readmissions or even tethering some of their payments to what kind of ratings they get from patients. And I was curious, you know, if any of you would want to kind of talk a little bit about how much we know about policies that actually lead to cost savings that aren't just cost shifting, and whether, because I think I heard some different interpretations here, but how much is the Affordable Care Act going to do in terms of not just shifting costs, but actually reducing how much health care costs? And maybe, Jonathan, I know I've read a lot of your writing on this, if you want to start us off.
Sure. So I think the Affordable Care Act does quite a bit to slow down, and we're never talking about costs going down in medical care. They always go up. It's a question of how fast do they go up. So we're talking about a reduced rate of growth. And I think the Affordable Care Act does some important things to slow down the rate of growth in Medicare, and some of those things are already in effect. I think it's highly uncertain what the overall impact of the Affordable Care Act is going to be on healthcare spending. It embraces a theory of cost control that I like to call faith-based cost control, because you have to believe in it, because there's actually not a lot of evidence that these things work, and maybe they will. Sometimes faith is rewarded, but if you start unpacking these things like accountable care organizations and medical homes, these things all sound good. They all sound great, and nobody wants to oppose them. I don't want to get up here and say I'm for unaccountable care or I want people to be medically homeless. So they're politically, they're very popular. How much money they're going to save is I think, a good question. And the recent slowdown we've had in healthcare spending actually started before the Affordable Care Act was passed. So unless you believe in the power of time travel, and the Affordable Care Act, after it was passed, went back in time and affected spending, I think we probably have put too much in the short term on it. Most of the reason healthcare spending has slowed is the economy and the economic slowdown. That's most of it. The rest of it, and we don't know how much the rest is, are other things. Going forward, I think the question is, will all these experiments in payment and delivery reform, will they work? And I don't think we have any idea. But will they work? They could work. Will we choose to implement the Cadillac tax, the tax on very high-cost private insurance plans in 2018? Are we going to do that? Or is the president in 2018 going to say, which economist's idea was it that it's great politically for me to tax people's health insurance? We're just going to put that off to 2028. Are we going to sustain the Medicare reforms? I think there the chances are very good that we will. And the one other note I will say about the Affordable Care Act is, regardless of what you heard in the election, and I don't want to be the one to suggest that not everything you hear is true, but regardless of what you heard, both parties believe in slowing down the rate of federal spending growth on health care. And the reason I know that is if you read Paul Ryan's budget, even though he doesn't want to say it very loudly, his budget assumes all the Medicare savings in the Affordable Care Act. So both parties, they disagree on how to do it, but they both want to do it. So there is at least some political will to build on there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, just to speak to the issue of healthcare spending first, I think there's no doubt that the healthcare spending will go up. I mean, it's really composed of two parts. One is the number of people in the system, and the other is the cost per service, cost of service that you deliver. And I think the numbers are just definitely going to go up with the demographics the way they are. And the fact that we are, you know, giving a lot of care at the end of life, even though we have some parts of the population being phased out, there are other parts that are getting a lot more care, is boosting the cost as well. So healthcare spending, with the numbers going up and the per-person cost of spending going up and the demographics going in the direction of people who cost more health-wise going up, is something that you can't really argue with. Whether the Affordable Care Act tackles the problem of cost of service, I mean, it's definitely boosting the numbers, so it's increasing spending by that route. Whether it tackles the question of cost saving, it's too early to tell. It really is. I think they're probably making a good effort to pull in the research that has happened, as Jonathan has rightly pointed out, over the last several years, where healthcare spending has been an issue and the cost of service has been an issue, is going to bring some results. There's definitely, you know, just like when you have any kind of new change in a program, there's definitely going to be some benefits of that. I think the early benefits are probably the low-hanging fruits. So if we have any part of the slowdown explained by research, reduction in cost of service, and the Affordable Care Act and whatever it's doing in that direction, it's probably the low-hanging fruits. And going forward, and there's a lot of low-hanging fruits, I guess, because it's an industry which has a lot of fat, but going forward, the reductions on the cost side are probably going to be greater challenges as we go ahead. And I think the issue that that Laura pointed out, which is that we're going to have two systems or a tiered system, is has always been the case and has now become a reality. The Affordable Care Act has kind of institutionalized it. The important thing is, will the Affordable Care Act hold up the bottom? You know, or will it let the bottom fall? Because that's the big challenge, is to make sure that the lower income groups who are pretty much at the mercy of states, because they are in the Medicaid program and states have a lot of flexibility. I mean, the Supreme Court decision gave them a lot of power. It confirmed that they have the right to decide what the reimbursement rates will be. They have the right to decide what the eligibility will be. And so a lot of this is going to play out at the state level, and the federal government is not going to have control on that, holding the bottom up. The only way it can do it is through the federalism system. And I think the important thing is, is this federal structure in the area of healthcare going to hold us in good stead going forward, or is that going to fall down? So,
Yeah, just a couple of things. I've always, I've actually grew up with Pollyanna, so I grew up with a very optimistic family, but I can find myself becoming optimistic about healthcare costs. And I remember when Obama was talking about this wasn't going to cost us a dime, or a nickel, I think is how he put it. I was trying to figure out, and I went through the entire Affordable Care Act trying to find places that we'd have cost controls, so I could tell my students, yes, we do. The accountable care organizations, for example, whether they work or don't work, are tiny little demonstration programs in Medicare alone. So I can't imagine they're going to have a huge impact compared to the fact that the drug companies, which right now I think are 12% of all costs, can just charge anything they want. So I think we have to weigh the cost controls, which are very minute, against the places that we don't have any cost controls. Added to that, of course, if we're going to cover, and I don't believe this is going to happen, but if we're going to cover, you know, over 30 million more people, I can't imagine that's not going to cost something. And if you add the long-term care, it's not just the 65 and over population, which really depresses me because I am what I study now when I turn 65. But it's the 85 and over population that really is the end of life, the long-term care, that is the most costly, and they're not going anywhere. the fastest population, the growing population in the United States, believe it or not, are people 100 and over. They are going to need good health care, expensive health care, and long-term care. So I have really, despite my optimistic personality, can find optimism for controlling health care costs in the system we have right now.
I'm going to ask one more question and then open it up to you all, so be thinking of any burning questions you have for our panelists. One of the things that's always struck me as kind of, you know, just as permanent as the wrong turns off DuPont Circle and, you know, all those things that are stick around Washington. Granted, I've been here less time than you all have kind of been around this debate. But that it seems like we're always, there's always talk of a tipping point on healthcare, that we're just at the point where we're spending too much. And it's kind of fun to go back and look at clips from the 1970s where people were saying, we're just spending too much on healthcare. It's not possible to spend anymore. And now we're spending trillions of dollars more than, you know, we were a few decades ago. And I'm curious, you know, if you all see, you know, is there a tipping point in healthcare spending? Or, you know, given that these are very popular programs of providing health insurance to tens of millions of Americans, that, you know, we just keep devoting a bigger part of our federal budget to them. Is there a space where we really do get serious about either capping or controlling what we're willing to spend on entitlement programs?
Well, first of all, when you said you haven't been around the debate as long as us, is that a nice way of saying you're a lot younger? I'm just trying to understand.
Going to no comment on that one as a journalist.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I it's a good point. You know, we used to talk in the United States that we can't go past 10% of GDP on medical care. And if we do, the country will fall apart. And, you know, we're about to go double than that. And I don't think there is a magic tipping point. I suspect that the tipping point is actually not in medical care or how much we spend on healthcare, but outside. What are the pressures from the deficit, and what are the pressures from other political changes? I don't think we get to some level and everybody says, okay, well, you know, $3 trillion a year on medical care, that wasn't too much, but 4.1, yeah, we've gone too far this time. So I think rather the where you get to that tipping point is a combination of pressures from the deficit and from the economy, and maybe those will moderate in the short run because the deficit has gone down significantly for this year, but not for long, so they'll come back. Pressures from politics and political realignments and political changes, and again, pressures from the Affordable Care Act. And here, and I'm not just saying this because I was born in Boston, but Massachusetts, we heard about California this morning, and actually one of the seven rules of public policy from our friend Deborah Stone is never believe that anything from California is going to happen elsewhere. So I will say that as a proviso. But if you look up in Massachusetts, that potentially could be the future for the rest of the country in that they expanded coverage. They didn't control costs at all. And very self-consciously said, we can't pass this. They didn't control costs at all. Now they're dealing with this sort of semi or near universal system where the costs are going up, and all of a sudden now they're in a position where politically they're adopting stronger cost controls. We don't know how strong yet, and are they going to work, but my guess is as the Affordable Care Act goes forward, that is a real possibility. The other possibility is not as good, which is if we take our conversation this morning, and if you're aligning constituencies and saying it's hardest to go after, just use the Paul Ryan budget as sort of revealed preference for the political strength of programs. Okay, Medicare is a bit harder to go after. Medicaid, you can really go after. Well, the Affordable Care Act beneficiaries, they're not organized, they're not demographically similar, they're not part of a program the same way Medicare beneficiaries are. So I think they're more politically vulnerable. And a concern I have going forward is, do we actually use the Affordable Care Act as an opportunity to control spending and maybe even do something system-wide, or we just reduce people's subsidies within the Affordable Care Act, which is another option, again, that's a cost-shifting option and one I wouldn't discount.
Great. Yeah, I think, you know, I can't disagree with any of the points that Jonathan made. I just want to sort of take this to another level, I guess, and that is the states. And I think, you know, there might not be a tipping point, and I don't really believe in tipping point theories. I think one of them was spoken about this morning, the one that drove Europe into austerity and to some extent the U.S. policies, was a
you know, just a flawed study. So I think the issue is really a budgetary constraint in politics, and I think the important thing will be at the state level as well as the federal level, that what happens in terms of both. And I think the constraints on the budget side are pretty extreme at the state level, and not so much in Texas, though we do speak about that issue. But I think California has had major problems, and it really, at some level, healthcare goes down to the local level as well with the public health systems and people's willingness to pay for public services. So within the public sector, I think the tipping point is something that individuals might have to sort of, in some sense, put their input into. Okay. So there really isn't a tipping point right now at the federal level, but there might be one more immediate one at the state and local level.
Yeah, I'm not sure, as a person who's not an economist, whether there is a tipping point. Certainly, you're right, it's going to be at the state level much earlier than at the national level. But the one thing that we haven't raised, and I get a lot of flack among my healthcare colleagues for this one, and I won't go into it, but I'll just raise it. In my own personal opinion, a great deal of the cost of healthcare is fraud and abuse. And I don't simply mean the usual views of fraud and abuse, but I think there is, in my own view, probably about a quarter of all Medicaid expenses and probably not as high but close in Medicare is being abused, financial abuse. I'm not even talking about patient abuse. So that is something I think that we as policymakers, we give lip service to, and we're constantly hearing about how we have to stop the fraud and abuse. But the companies and places that really are financially abusing, that's where the money is, Medicare and Medicaid. And it's pretty easy to tap into that money. And these are the same people that are paying the lobbying for our Congress and our state legislators. And that, I think, really needs a lot more effort.
Great. Well, I want to open it up to you all. If you don't, we're going to have some microphones coming around. And if you don't mind just telling us who you are and where you are from, we can start up here.
Hi, Elaine Kmark from Brookings. And Sarah, I've been watching your coverage in the Post. Congratulations. I'm glad somebody's paying such attention to it.
Thank you.
Even if you are young, it's your job. I wanted to ask, I mean, maybe Shama, but the rest of you too, what do you think the effect on premium prices is going to be of the provisions in the ACA that require all this extra stuff to be included in the insurance companies that are on the exchanges? And will that become then an excuse and or trigger, depending on your point of view, for premium increases to then, sort of morph into the non-subsidy section of the healthcare community? What's your take on that?
I think that's a very valid point. If you want to improve the quality of care going forward, you can do it two ways. One is try to learn from the research that's happening and improve the efficiency. And to the extent you can do that, I think the insurance companies and the providers are already doing some of that. Premiums may not go up. But for most part, they're in this business. They're private. They're in this business for profit, and so to the extent that they can, premiums will go up if you ask for greater service. And that's, I'm not quite sure if I got the second part of your question about morphing into the subsidy area. Well, the government's.
Premiums are going up for people in the who are not affected.
Right.
And then being blamed, and this is a political question, really. And
right. Right, right. I think the impact of the ACA through the federalized system, particularly Medicare, which is a large monopoly purchaser of healthcare, is essentially going to be pretty substantial, and there is an element that that could come back as a criticism of the increasing costs being due to ACA. But on the other hand, I think, you know, if ACA sort of tries to message the implementation of this act as being more about incorporating better research or better ways of delivering services into the you know, into the provision of healthcare, we might get a different kind of message, political message coming out of it. So I think a lot of it will depend on how the Obama administration and the states. I mean, the states are major players in this, even though, you know, Texas is not a player in this context, but and some of the other Republican states. But most of the states have adopted this, and one way or the other, they are being affected by it, and so they will need to take this into account. That it depends on how that goes forward. States, incidentally, are the regulators of the insurance industry, so they play a big part in this discussion about the pricing, and they certainly have discretion in deciding the reimbursement rates on Medicaid. Where so yeah, I think the states are probably going to push for more services at lower cost, and you know, what might eventually happen in the subsidized area is that people are going to get poorer and poorer quality care. I think the issue of the quality of care is an important one to watch out for going forward. I mean, more people will be covered, but what will be the quality of care? And I think there's nothing wrong with having a tiered system of health care and having basic health care provided to everybody, but then better health care depending on your income and affordability in your individual context. But it's important to sort of be able to hold the bottom at some reasonable level for a developed country comparable to other OECD countries. And I think in a globalized world that that is something we need to be doing for economic reasons, not for social or moral reasons, but really for economic reasons. And I think the states recognize that as well. I mean, it's an important issue at the state level. Attracting businesses and such like would be an issue if this is not in some sense tractable for businesses.
Okay. I know I saw a lot of hands go up earlier, so I'm wondering if we get to the next question, maybe right behind you.
Thayer Phillips from Retire Safe. It seems to me that the only way we can cut costs of health care is get rid of the fraud and abuse, like was mentioned, get rid of unneeded services, put the consumer a little bit closer to the service so that they can maybe get rid of some of those services. Early detection, which then keeps us from a disease that costs a lot of money if you can detect and cure it or stop it at that point. And then finally, discovering a cure that would keep us from having the disease. I don't see any other ways of truly cutting the cost without shifting, cutting the cost. Any legislation in the last 4 years that gets us closer to solving or attaining those?
So one of my favorite sources for health policy is the well-known journal, The Onion. And The Onion published a cartoon some years ago that said, despite all medical progress, the death rate has held steady at 100%. And I pass this out to my medical students the first day of class as a reminder to the limits of medicine. So, to take these really quickly, the Affordable Care Act does do some things to try and invest in prevention and early detection, as you put it. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good evidence that that actually saves money. And in fact, one of the signature works on that was published by Brookings many, many years ago, Louise Russell, an economist, because it depends what type of prevention you're talking about, but with a lot lot of prevention in medicine, we have to try and detect across a broad range of people to find the ones who actually have the thing, and then we find people who might have it. PSA is a great example of this, and we start treating them. So prevention doesn't not necessarily save money. Unnecessary services is everybody's favorite, and there's no question that we provide a lot of unnecessary services. The problem is those unnecessary services are other people's income in the healthcare industry. So they think they're very necessary to their bottom line. It's also difficult to figure out exactly what, you know, what makes it unnecessary. If I have a pain in my lower back, is it because I was grading too many papers and I tried to bring them all home and I should just, you know, rest for a couple days? Or does that pain in my lower back indicate that I might have something more serious? I have no idea. And so figuring out what exactly is unnecessary is very difficult. And on the cure front, again, you know, dying, there's no way around death, even on this panel. And so no matter what we do in terms of cure and making progress, people are still going to die, and that's a very, very expensive thing. And probably the final thing we should keep in mind is, if you ask why is the United States more expensive than all those other countries that Sarah was referring to at the outset, most of the reason is not because we're providing more services. We're actually not, for big categories of services. Most of it is because we have much higher administrative costs and much higher prices, and that provides an opportunity, I think, to try and reduce spending as well.
Great. I think we have time for one more question right back there. But I think we'll be happy to answer them afterwards if anyone say lingering ones.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Grace Gerardi. I'm with My Democracy. I want to know, in terms of lifespan, the United States has one of the lowest in developing countries' lifespan, and in contrast to other countries and their healthcare costs. Is that being weighed in at all? I mean, we're talking so much about, finance and less about care and actual care as opposed to quality care.
Well, you know, you really do have to disaggregate the statistics because we also have a relatively high infant mortality rate. But if you look at which people have the high, if you look at certain income classes, people covered with health insurance and so on, we probably rate at the highest longevity, and we probably rate at the lowest income infant mortality. It just depends on whether you're talking by race, whether you're talking income, whether you're talking about class. So it's people that don't have health insurance, people with very low incomes, that have the very high infant mortality rate, not the rest of America. So you have to disaggregate the numbers.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming. I think our panelists deserve a round of applause for their excellent answers. I think we're happy to answer any questions you might have lingering, and have a good afternoon.